Hey, hello, hi, welcome to and or back to the Equitheory podcast. I am your host, Jill Therese, and this week's episode, I am actually interviewing someone. This will be the first interview of the podcast, and I am so excited to be bringing you guys interviews, finally. And with Shelby on this episode, it's a bit more conversational, and in my usual style, we go all over the place and tackle a wide array of topics surrounding the controversial practice of stalling. And this will be the first in a series that I kind of want to talk about. You know, I'll probably do some of them by myself. I might have some interviews, who knows? But I want to do a series called Controversial Practices. And if you're listening to this, it's probably already titled that, so you know that. But yeah, we've kind of just like hit all of the marks. And I want to preface this episode by saying at no point was any of our comments meant to shame or make anybody feel less than or anybody feel like you're doing something wrong by your horse. If anything, if something we say strikes a chord with you, maybe consider it and think on it from a new perspective and see if you agree or disagree. And if you disagree, totally fine. You keep doing what you're doing. We'll keep doing what we're doing. The goal is never to target the person, but rather the practice or the action. And I don't think that necessarily stalling your horse, even if it's 24/7, means that you're a bad person or anything like that. I think genuinely that we're all trying to do best by our horses. And I want to put that out there before we jump into this episode, because me and Shelby both have very strong tendencies to advocate very loudly about welfare. And I think it's an important conversation to hear, even though it might be a little uncomfortable. But just know you're in a safe space. Nobody's attacking you. But just maybe reevaluate if you're somebody that is really into stalling. So without further ado, let's get on into this episode. Alrighty, guys, if you're willing and able, check us out at Jet Reel Podcast on your Patreon app or at patreon.com/JetReelPodcast. When you become a patron of the podcast, you can ask me questions that I'll answer on the podcast, receive merch, and have access to live Q&A events, which means you get your questions answered in real time. At the higher tiers, you have the option for phone call consults with me on air or privately, as well as access to online training with me, depending on your tier. Ooh, fun. Lastly, should you decide to become a patron, just know you can cancel at any time and subscribe and unsubscribe as you please. And if you can't support us through Patreon, absolutely no worries at all. Listening alone is more than enough. And I just want to say thank you to all the current and future patrons. Me and the ponies appreciate it endlessly. Anyway, I'm going to stop talking and we're going to get into the part where I talk about things you're interested in. All right, everybody, I have got Shelby Dennis on the line for those of you who may not know. Shelby, would you mind introducing yourself, telling us a bit about who you are and what you do?
Hi, I live in British Columbia, Canada, and I've been riding horses since I was 4 years old, and I'm now 24. And for the last 3 or 4 years, I've been running my own training business called Milestone Equestrian, where I mostly work with thoroughbreds on and off the track, because I also gallop at the racetrack. And then I also specialize in young horses. And I'm very passionate about like equine well-being and how it influences their overall behavior under saddle. And that's something that I'm trying to bring into my program more and more to better the lives of horses.
Awesome. I think we're both definitely on the welfare advocacy train. And so pretty sure everybody that listens to this podcast is probably semi-like-minded. So yeah, so I've got some questions here and we can just kind of let it flow and see what comes out of both of our faces. So you've become pretty, like a pretty big advocate about keeping horses in stalls and advocating for turnout. So first, like, what's your general position on stalling as a practice?
Like the one thing that I'll say that is probably the most radical is that I do not believe that like horses actually need to be stalled. I know that some people
How dare you?
But I think like I know some horses do freak out when you put them in turnout, but it's like the same thing as like a dog with separation anxiety is something to work on behavior wise. So I don't think horses need stalls, but I understand the convenience factor of them and like how they might be necessary for show horses sometimes. But I think they are vastly overused, and I think we need to move to a point where everyone just views it as unacceptable for the horse to spend more time stalled than it does outside.
I could not agree more with you. I mean, I know, like, it's just such a weird concept that, you know, everybody always says, like, you wouldn't keep a dog in a cage all day. Why would you keep a horse in a 12x12? And I think a lot of people are starting to realize, especially with, like, COVID and the quarantine, we don't like being stuck in our houses all day, unable to see our friends and bored. And I think a lot of people are starting to realize the that's a metaphor for how the horses are kind of feeling.
Oh, for sure. And I think that, like, the thing that I've noticed the most is, like, a lot of people that do stall their horses too much, they'll be the same types of people that would advocate against people getting, like, working dogs and keeping them in apartments or kenneled for too long. So there's a lot of cognitive dissonance for some people.
Yeah,
I think more and more people are starting to wake up about it, because initially, like, when I first started on this tear about turnout, like, several years ago now, like, I got so much backlash all the time, and now I still get it, but it's less.
I definitely relate to you in that regard, because the positive reinforcement thing is also, it's the same thing, you know. I mean, people do things to horses, and then if you flipped it to a dog, Archie, I told you, not now, go away. He said, I need my voice to be heard. But, like, you know, when you point out, would you do it to a dog? They're like, well, okay, but dogs are different. And that's the way that you reduce the cognitive dissonance, because you can't simultaneously treat an animal in an unethical manner and say that you love them and they're your whole world. You would take a bullet for them and then treat them like that. So the only way relieve that is to say it's not hurting them.
Yeah, and I think it's weird because, like, with dogs, in my opinion, it would be more justifiable to be harsh on them because they're predators. So in theory, they would be more likely to be aggressive than
right.
would. And I'm not saying that people should hit their dogs.
Right.
I'm just saying that from a logical standpoint, it makes even less sense to hit a flight animal.
Exactly.
And get super mad at them.
And I'm with you. And it's horses work off of two main things: food and fear. And so we often obviously take the fear route in lesser forms, but this is not that podcast.
Oh yeah, no, we're sidetracked.
Welcome to it. I guarantee you it will continue to happen, but that's okay.
Oh, for sure. People with ADHD in one room.
No joke. Okay, so secondly, let's talk about how you keep your personal horses.
So with my personal horses, like, I still wish I had more room for them, and that's something I'll acknowledge, because I wish that they had, like, more space to move around to, like, different locations within a field.
Yeah, me too.
They're probably in, like, a 1-acre dry lot, and I recently did get that field that I keep them out on, so I kind of, like, I'll bring them back and forth to the field, and I'll take them off of it to let the grass rest every now and then so they don't destroy all the grass. But that field is pretty big, and, like, it has a whole gallop track, so they can, like, go flying down it, which
awesome.
Like, I can understand why it makes people nervous, because I would way rather watch my thoroughbreds galloping like that with someone on them to make sure they're not going to make bad decisions. But they're having so much fun, so I try to keep, like, I would, at this point, I wouldn't want to have my horses anywhere long-term where their turnout is not big enough for them to run in. If they can't pick up a good canter and play around, it's too small, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. In the short term, like, I would keep my horses in-and-outs occasionally. Like, I've done that before when I brought Milo to my trainers. But it's pretty clear the change in the behavior once you take them out of a herd environment where they can run around and put them in. Like, even if they can talk to horses over the fence, if you put them in an in-and-out from that, like, it's a clear change in behavior that you can't ignore.
Yeah.
My horses have, like, they're all out together, and they have, like, a shelter, and then I give them free choice hay, and they're out on that 1-acre dry lot for most of the time. And then now that I have that field in the summer, they're going to be going there in the summer, but they would kill themselves there in the winter because I live in a rainforest, and the hill is not that steep, but it's steep enough that, like, Percy fell and slipped and fell on his side because he was dicking around with Pogo. So when it's wet out, like, I don't want this to do that. But otherwise, like, they're outside year-round with a shelter. Like, I do not put them in stalls unless they're injured.
And I mean, I'm pretty much the same here. You know, it's not my facility, but in recent years, I have, like, decided I literally refuse to move from here until I can get a place where I know that I will have control over her feed and her turnout, and the space and who she's with and things like that, because like I cannot fathom going to another boarding barn. The one I was at before I moved here, she had a stall and it had like a turnout, and I'm so bad at estimating like distance, but I think it was probably like, I don't know, 70 meters across or something like that. American metric here, and the only reason is because I can estimate because I know how big a 20 meter circle is. That's about it. But so I mean, that was absolutely not enough. I mean, she could not take off running, and the paddock she's in now is still arguably too small, but she is barefoot, and all of our other fields get so wet, and it's evident in the horse's feet, and they have to be on a tighter trim cycle, and it's just it's very stressful. But I mean, I don't know. Zoe's, she's calmed down a lot in her recent years, since I've stopped competing, and she's really mellowed out. So I hardly ever see her playing around unless it's like a cooler morning. But I mean,
I find the mares are more like they're like women. They're more mature than the boys are, like, 'cause mine are all clowns.
Yeah. We don't need to go out and play in the dirt. Thank you very much. Yeah. I mean, obviously I would like it to be bigger and for them to, like you said, have some terrain to deal with, some different like places to explore rather than just, you know, a big square. But it's also difficult because, we had like a super wet, a summer last year, so we couldn't plant any grass, so everything is dead and just weeds, and it sucks, and it keeps raining. So I mean, every time we try to go to plant, it rains, and to get rid of the weeds, you have to take the horses off the paddocks and do pesticides, and that's dangerous, and we don't have enough room because we have way too many horses here, and Arkansas is not a buyer's market. So it's, I mean, it's a mess, but we're doing the best we can, and I mean, that is, you know, That's all you can do. Yeah.
Because it does depend on region. Like, if I were to move to Alberta or, like, even further up north in BC, my horses could be out on hundreds of acres. Mm-hmm. But I live, like, near the city-ish. Like, I'm still out in the countryside, but I'm still close to the city. And, like, I'm actually considering moving into the interior eventually so that they can have that.
That's so funny.
I can't get that here unless I can spend $4 million, which, of course, is not going to happen.
Yeah.
But it's hard because then, like, the ability to work changes the further out you go because you wouldn't have as many clients.
So right. And that's where I'm thinking, because I have been to both Colorado and Florida in recent years, and I have learned that my skin absolutely cannot handle it because I just break out in eczema, which is fantastic. Thank you, immune system.
Oh, no.
Texas seems to be okay, and Texas has a huge, you know, horse industry, and they also have a ton of land, and it's all different depending on what part of Texas you're in. And so I'm also considering moving so that I can have a place that, you know, is A, land is cheaper, and B, I can actually have land. Because like I said, I cannot imagine moving somewhere. Like, if I have to move and I can't get a place, whether I buy it or if I rent it or board, like if I don't have control over Zoe's feed and how she is handled and her turnout and all of that, like she'll stay here. I absolutely have to move.
That's where I'm at too. Like, I had someone say to me, like, I was having a debate about turnout with someone that didn't agree with me, and they said, like, well, what would you do if you had to go to university across the country and your only options were to install them? And I straight up said, I was like, I wouldn't bring them.
Exactly. Yeah.
I mean,
I'm with you.
Stay home. And like, worst case scenario, if I, like, for whatever reason, I don't see why this would happen, but if I could not have my horses unless they were in small paddocks and stalls, then they would all have to be sold
because
people who could do the right thing. But
I agree. I mean, if I was ever in a situation where I could not take care of Zoe or any of the other horses that I'm steadily acquiring, I moved out here with Zoe, and I am going to leave with Zoe, Amber, and Azula.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like, whatever.
That's what happens.
Yeah, I know. I know. That's how my boss ended up with 50. So,
yeah. Oh,
and
God.
She's like, it's going to happen to you too. And I was like, no, yeah. God. But I mean, I've told her, I was like, if I can't do it, she's yours. And she was like, you know, I'd take her. So, I mean, I also have that backup plan because I would never subject her to living in a stall 24/7 all over again. Like, I mean, I just, but we're getting ahead of ourselves because I have questions about that. Okay. So, Can you talk a bit about what you used to believe and what made you change your mind to what you believe now?
It's been a journey, because, like, when I showed Arabs, it was very, very normal to have the horses stalled most of the day.
Oh, so my God, yeah. At the last barn that I was at, it was an Arab barn. Those horses were in 24-7 yeah. all day long.
Oh, it's bad.
And they would get turned out, like, maybe once a week into the arena.
And they'd be like, oh, they don't like it. They're scared. It's like, no, he's going crazy, Karen. He's losing his shit.
Has never been able to run around, and that's why you have to have a shank that is longer than my shin bone to ride it.
Yeah. So my, like, Arab barn. So I, the first barn that I was at for Arabs, it had more turnout than the one I moved to after. Like, they had some fields, but they only really used them for the brood mares. And then the rest was probably small, maybe 20 by 20 or 30 by 30 sand paddocks. So very small. Mm-hmm. And then stalls. So they would go out in the paddock that's minimally bigger than the stall for, like, I don't know, 6-7 hours a day, and then they'd go back inside. And then I moved to another barn, same thing, small paddocks. Some of them were like only 15 by 15, and then the stalls were either 10 by 10 or 12 by 12, jeez, depending on how lucky you were. And they even did something where they were like, where a lot of people thought their horses didn't like the rain. And, like, the important thing for this is that I live in a rainforest. It rains honestly 80% of the year here. So there's people there that had their horses on no rain turnout, and my trainer recommended it. So initially my era was on no rain turnout. Mm-hmm. And then I started to kind of feel bad for him because he was always inside. And then I started to say, put him out in the rain, and they tried to tell me that he didn't like it. And I was like, you know, I don't really care if he has to stand out in the rain and kind of sulk until he realizes it's not that bad to get wet. Yeah. But he needs a change of pace. Like, he needs more stimulation. Mm-hmm. And they were, yeah, they would probably go out around, like, 8 or 9, and then they'd be in by, like, 4, if they did go out. And there also weren't enough paddocks for all the horses at the property, so they had to rotate.
That's how the last barn was, and some horses only got to get out maybe once a week, and that it sucked. And to your point about rain, it's so funny, because Zoe, like, you can look at her out in the pasture, and if it starts getting dark or drizzling, she pins her ears and bolts to her shelter. She is a prisspot about rain, but she has the option. If she would like to stand out in the rain, she can, and if she would not, she also has a nice, cozy shelter. And, I think at least if you have your horse out on turnout, they definitely need shelter. The thing that makes me the most sad is when horses, like, I mean, you always see those backyard farms, like, where somebody's just got, like, I don't know, basically a dog pen in their backyard that's got a horse, and there's no shelter, no friends, no nothing, and you're like, oh my God, that horse is going to kill itself. Yes.
Yeah, shelter's a must, and, like, that's the thing that I don't get with people who say their horses don't like being outside, because you could essentially make a stall, like, shelter. And then they could have the choice, and that's why In-N-Out paddocks work so well for, like, horses in cities, is because, like, even though they're small, at least if they get stressed in the stall, they can walk outside. And it's not much, but it's better than nothing.
Well,
but,
and I think I mean, I don't know, you would know more about this than I would, but I think if there were to be a study done where horses that had been stalled all their lives, and if you were to put them in a stall that had the option to go outside, I think you would see the horses most likely, especially, like, if it was decent weather, spending way more time outside than they were in their stall.
Absolutely. Like, I think what would happen initially is if they're really used to being stalled, they'd start out creeping out slowly and then coming back. And eventually they'd extend their horizons to use the whole field. And that's the thing. Like, I've said that to people before that are like, my horse doesn't like being outside. They love their stall. And I'm like, open the door and see what happens. Like, leave the door open.
Right.
I doubt they're going to stay in the stall.
It's the same thing. Like, if you were raised in your house for all your life, like, freaking Rapunzel, you know, I don't know if you've ever seen Tangled, but she's like, I would like to be outside of this tower. But I mean, you don't know what's going to happen, but steadily you go further and further. I didn't mean to make a point with a Disney princess, Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
But I mean, you would be like, I'm going stir crazy. I would like to see what's out there. And it would be scary at first, but then you would realize all the awesome things that are out there and the freedom and the ability to move.
Yeah, I think that's the biggest thing, is that people aren't patient enough to let them settle in. And, like, the one thing people need to consider is that a horse going, like, most stalls that I see don't even have bars between them. So we're talking fully boarded walls with bars only at the front. And the horse is going from that to suddenly being in a wide open space where there's likely other animals and lots of new things. Like, the level of stress that would, even for a person, if you lived in a padded room your whole life, and then all of a sudden they threw you out into, like, a busy, like, park park-like surroundings with lots of other people around, they probably have a panic attack too. And that's with us having the ability to rationalize. And you could even have like someone tell you, hey, this is going to be way different. It's going to be wide open space, but you'd still get the panic response. And it's like seen in abuse victims and children that haven't been cared for properly, where they'll have certain behaviors that are from like dealing with trauma essentially. And I think that's the horses. They're kind of trauma victims.
Right. And if they are never socialized either, like, I mean, it's just like a dog. If you never socialize it, it's going to come out with problems. And that may lead you to believe that your animal does not like being outside or being with other horses. They can't get along with other horses, but it's likely due to the fact that they've never had to experience it before.
Oh, for sure.
Frightening.
Like, even stallions can go out in herds, and that's something that a lot of people do not realize, is that, like, the horse being a stallion isn't a reason to isolate them. Like, you need to be careful with their turnout, and you need to not probably paddock them next to mares. But they can still go out with friends, and, like, that's one of the things with Banksy that I found weird, because everyone is so worried about him being steady and, like, wondering why I haven't chopped his nuts off yet.
But, yeah,
like,
how tall is he going to be, by the way?
He's, like, 14'3", 15 pounds. Like, yeah. He's big. But, like, he's out with other geldings that put him in his place, and he's not, like, he doesn't even know what girls are right now.
Right,
so
well, and that's the difference. We have two studs here right now. One is not ours, and one is ours, and the one is, like, in his 20s, that's ours, and he has never been out with another horse before. And the times that he has been, like, I wasn't here for it, but allegedly it was quite the bloodbath, and it was gelding versus stud. There was no mare involved, but I mean, he just doesn't know how to interact with other horses. And
yeah, I think that's why it needs to happen early, especially for stallions, early in life.
Yeah, I mean, if you were to keep Banksy as a stud, he would probably be fine to be out with all your guys for the rest of his life. But, yeah. I mean, I feel like it sucks. But, I mean, they're both in paddocks, and they're next to other horses, but they just can't touch them, which absolutely breaks my heart, because that is not how horses are designed to live. And, I mean, it would be like us. I mean, if you could never talk to another human, you could just see them. Like, that sucks.
Yeah, it's like seeing someone through a glass, like, soundproof window.
Yeah, and
it's, you can't get through.
Yeah,
it's sad.
So anyway, got you off track a little bit. So a bit about what you used to believe and what made you change your mind to now.
Biggest change, I would say, like, this is before I even, like, was starting to look up studies, but I eventually got pretty burnt out showing the Arab circuit, and I moved my horse away from a show barn to, like, just a kind of backyard boarding barn that had, it was on, like, I think it's on, like, 40 acres. So it had, like, big turnout fields, and then when the horses did come inside for dinner, they always had in-and-out paddocks, but they'd be out in the field all day. And my Arab went from being something that, like, he, every day when you would ride him, he would spook at the same end of the arena, and he was a bolter as well, so every now and then he'd just bolt on people. He went from being like that to being, like, completely beginner safe, not spooking at anything, like, really, really easy to work with and ride.
Yeah.
So it was such a stark change in behavior that, like, you can't ignore that, you know? And the only variable that had really changed drastically was that he was actually going outside.
Right. And it's kind of like how people say, like, you know, OTTBs are insane because they're all hyped up and they live in stalls. But those horses see more than most horses do in their entire life at the track. Yeah. And so they get habituated to all of the excitement going on. And when your horse is outside, he gets used to noises and cars and people and stuff. Whereas in the stall, he's, you know, very safe and everything is protected. Yeah, sheltered. Exactly.
Well, and the thing with racehorses too is that in the off season, like, this is why, like, I don't agree that racetracks shouldn't have, like, at least in and out paddocks.
Yeah, I so wish they did, but it's
my thing with the racing industry is that most of the trainers I know, all of their horses go out on large turnouts for the whole off season.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, like, a show horse doesn't generally get that. Like, if the owner's keeping them stalled or in a small paddock, they usually do it year round because they're too worried about them getting injured. So they don't get the same level of freedom even. And their careers also span way longer.
Right.
So they have to deal with it for years and years.
Right. Especially at, like, the upper level dressage and show jumper barns, they, you know, for some reason, I think eventers tend to be like, ah, it's fine. Leave it outside. But there are some that leave them in stalls. But I think mostly the jumpers and hunters and dressage, those ones tend to be more You know, keep them safe. Don't let them get hurt or dirty. And I mean, obviously not everyone, but they have long lasting careers, like you said, and it's not just the couple of years that they're good for racing, and they often live their entire lives in stalls. And I mean, it sucks for the thoroughbreds at the track. Cause I mean, like here we have the big track Oaklawn, and it's like, they just have a bunch of barns with a bunch of stalls. And that, I mean, like you said, I really wish that they had turnouts too, but it's, you know, money, land issues. Yeah. But at the same time, at least those horses are getting out every day and getting exercised for, you know, an hour. Yeah. It's something.
And they hand walk them a fair amount too. I don't know. Like, it's something that I would like to see change, but like, the difference, I guess, is that a show jumper could find a barn that they could turn their horse out at, whereas the racetracks here, like, none of them have turnout.
Right, and I mean, so our trainers do the same thing that you're talking about. Like, they're all turned out in the off season, and they all have space and get to be horses, but it's, I wish we could work on that, but I mean, it's a money thing, and it, like you said, you have an option when you just have one horse versus 50. But so I guess we can move on to, I have a list, but I would like for you to mention some of the problems that you see with stalling, like some of the, you know, issues that come with it for the horses.
So there's lots. So the biggest thing would be is that if you were to walk through a barn of stalled horses, there's going to be a very high percentage of horses with vices.
Right.
And this goes for any barn. It doesn't matter what barn you walk through. It's all of them. If the horses are stalled most of the time, they're going to have way more vices than any barns. And these can be like weaving or cribbing, stall walking, wood chewing, like just pinning their ears at people, trying to bite them when they walk by, showing aggression to other horses when they walk by, pawing at the door, rearing up over the stall walls, like all of those things. You'll see the occurrence of those things way more in barns that do not have adequate turnout than you will in turned out barns. And that even goes, like, we do have horses at my farm that crib, even though we got good turnout here, but they arrived here as cribbers. They didn't become cribbers in our care. And like the biggest thing that I noticed, like with that kind, like I read a bunch of studies on it, and it's like a proven thing through study that stalled horses have more vices, and stall vices do not exist in the wild. It's something that we've created from stressing out horses too much.
That makes perfect sense. And I mean, it would stand to reason that there's also a high, if not near total, percentage of those horses probably have ulcers. I mean, like,
I think it's 75% of all competition horses have ulcers.
Yeah,
unless they're being preventatively treated.
Yeah,
and that's like what I've noticed is, like, the trainer that I've worked for the most at the track, she has her own farm, so what she would do is after races she brings horses home and puts them out, and they get to go out in paddocks and just kind of decompress at the farm. And her barn, like, I have never seen any of her horses crib if she's had them since they were young. If they started out their racing career with her, they do not have stall vices. The ones who do are all the ones that arrived after.
They still have to get
stalled at the track, and they're still in their stalls longer than other horses. And honestly, like, it's more stalling than I would personally want for, like, horses. But it's a very stark difference if you compare her barn to barns that do not do the same thing. And yeah, I've noticed it, like, walking around other barns, there's like the stall walking problems. And then under saddle, these horses tend to have more problems. They'll be pissier, they'll buck more, they'll rear more, they'll be more hot and high strung. And they're more liable, like, if you pull a horse out of a stall, even on like a lunging day, they're more liable to blast around like an idiot and be super, super high strung when they come out, because they have to burn all of their energy at once. And I would compare it to, like, Marsh, like my friend that I met on Tumblr many years ago, she's a behaviorist, and I asked her what the zoomies were for dogs, and she said that it's like, it's called like frap, she called it frapping, it's like frenetic something play play, and it's basically they burn a ton of energy all at once when they've had too much pent-up energy, or something excites them and they have too much energy and it needs to get out. And I think that the horses coming out of stalls are like that,
and that's where we get the my horse doesn't like to be out of stall, he absolutely loses his mind, he's so scared.
I don't know if they're necessarily always scared, but they have to run because they'd get no other chance to.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, I'm saying that that's the justification for trying to keep them inside.
Oh, it's silly. And it's so silly.
I agree. And I mean, that's like, you know, when I was at the Arabian barn that I mentioned, when Zoe had a really small turnout coming from, you know, she lived here on the farm that I'm at for her whole life, and then she moved to live at a really big farm, and then to move to another really big farm, and then move to this teeny tiny itty bitty little paddock. And I don't know if you remember or if my followers on the podcast know, she got, when she had colic surgery 2 years ago, it's because she got cast in her stall. And I mean, who knows if she colicked because she got cast or if she got cast because she was colicking. But I mean, that's a huge issue. Horses don't get cast in the wild. Yeah. And I think she probably colicked because, A, we were feeding her shitty food. And I had no idea about nutrition at the time, and I'm, like, flabbergasted by that. But also, there's no doubt she had ulcers. We weren't treating her for it because everybody, you know, everybody I rode under was like, oh, she's just super hot. And I was like, okay, sounds good. You know, she had ulcers, and it was absolutely insane. When I moved her out here, she weaved and bobbed and, would just, I mean, she just did all those things that, you know, you see like the TikTok videos of, and you're like, oh my God, my horse is so silly. Look at how he's dancing the music. And it was so annoying to me at shows, you know, cause I'd hang a stall guard up so she could see out. Cause I mean, they're often those boarded up stalls, and, she would just bob and weave. And when I would come back, people would be standing there like nodding at her being like, yeah, yes, you're so pretty. Yes. And I was like, please go away.
She's stressed.
Yes. I was like, please stop. And when I moved out here, I, you know, I kind of knew that, but I still kind of thought it was funny. And it was interesting because she was only on turnout. Like in the winter, she would go out during the daytime and in at night, and then the reverse in the summer. But right before she got brought in, she would weave like uncontrollably and just like, I mean, she would just stand at the gate an hour before she was supposed to get fed, and she would just put her head over the fence and weave back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And at shows, she would, there's a video in one of my Texas Rose vlogs where she is standing in the corner of her stall, like bumping her nose against the wall, like an insane asylum patient. And I was like, oh, we've lost her. Like she's acting crazy, but I didn't think anything of it. And I mean, and it's so fascinating to me that she was still outside when she was weaving, but she knew she was about to come in and it was making her anxious. And now that she's outside 24/7, and still, I mean, she gets fed at the same time, but she doesn't weave before she gets fed anymore, unless the dude that feeds is late or whatever. But then she gets a little anxious. But for the most part, she has completely stopped weaving because she's outside and she's not anticipating needing to be brought in, and it doesn't make her anxious anymore. And weaving, like, I don't know if most people know, it's like really, really bad for their joints and legs. And
they go catatonic when they get, if they're bad enough, like they'll don't see anything. Like you could walk beside them and they'd weave into you. Like they're really bad weavers. It's bad.
Yeah. And Zoe was like that. I mean, you could walk up to her and she would just knock into you, and she'd flip her head and stick her tongue out of the side of her mouth and do like a jaw stretch. And it was just like, and I just thought it was funny. Because I mean, that's what you get taught.
People compare it to dancing, and it's because we're so poorly educated on horses from a behavioral and like physiological 100%. Perspective. Like with the colic thing, that's one thing that I forgot to mention for your question is colic's the number one killer of horses outside from old age. So they're most likely to, if they're going to die early, it's most likely to be because of colic, and the rate of colic absolutely skyrockets with like, however long they're in a stall, it goes up. And so like we know this, they found this in studies too, and like the reason for that is because they don't have the same range of motion to kind of walk around and graze, and they're also stressed, so they're more likely to have problems from being stressed, and like colic is one of those huge risk factors. So for people, like a lot of people say that they don't want their horse to get hurt in a turnout, but they're more likely to have to die early from colic than anything else.
Yeah, well, and not only that, but, like, you don't want your horse to get hurt in turnout. But if your horse isn't, like, spends most of his day not using his body, he's going to become fragile. And oh, yeah. You don't, like, I mean, you know, every conditioning book I've ever read is, like, maybe for, like, 20 minutes once a week, you know, take your horse for a jog down concrete because it helps firm up their bones. I don't know if there's any evidence to that because I have not fact checked that. But I mean, like, to some degree, you need a little bit of impact training to help the body adapt and, you know, tear those muscles and then rebuild and make it stronger, blah, blah, blah. And when they're in a stall all the time, they can't do that. And that's why I think you get a lot of upper level horses in, you know, when they're stalled, that they end up with a lot of soft tissue injuries.
Oh, yeah. I think that, too, could be related to the reduced circulation from standing around. Like, I'm not a doctor, but I would assume if they're not properly circulating their blood in the same way they could if they're moving around all the time, then the tendons would be more susceptible to injury.
Yeah. And, I mean, and also, like, as far as body functioning goes, like, a lot of people avoid turning horses out when it's cold because they think they'll be warmer in the barn. And that entirely depends on if you have a heating unit in your barn. If you don't, and it's not insulated, like, we had, like, at the Salem, the barn I was at for the longest, it was, like, concrete bricks. And I had Zoe inside, you know, during the winter, and I was like, oh, it's warmer. It's definitely not warmer in there, not significantly anyway. And when horses are able to move around and have space in, like, a paddock, they actually stay warmer because of their body heat. And they're generating.
Well, the funny thing about that is that, like biologically, horses cope way better with, like, the cold than they do the heat. So it's kind of, it's a funny thing that people fixate on because they're more likely to have problems from going and showing on a hot summer day than they are from being turned out in the winter.
Right. And like, I live in which Canada, one are you more likely so, like, to do?
Like, people have their horses out in Alberta in, like, minus 40. And, like,
which is ridiculous to me, by the way, just throwing that out there. That doesn't compute with my brain. Cause yeah. I mean,
I would die there too. Cause it's not that it does not get that cold here, but
no, it, the coldest it gets here, I could not tell you what it is in Celsius, but in Fahrenheit, it is like maybe 19. Sometimes we hit that. And I mean, it's below freezing, but it's still not as cold as it could be. And everybody's like, Southerners don't know what cold is. I'm like,
yeah.
And that's the thing. I mean, with the horses too, we think that their bodies operate the same way ours do. So if you walk outside and you're cold, you're like, oh, my horse needs a blankie and he needs to be brought inside. And it's like, they have a layer of, like, they have a coat. Also, they're not designed for that. They are outdoor animals. They are designed to be outside. So they're not going to be the same temperature you are. And that's not a very good basis for whether or not, you know, the horse should be outside if it would be better off. But I'm trying to think. Some other issues that I have listed here are not access to constant forage inside. I mean, like, I know our horses that are stalled here because we don't have enough hay. Because, I mean, like I said, the winter, or I'm like, oh my God, what's, oh my God, I'm having a stroke. What season? When it rained in the summer, we did not get good grass growth. So, like, there's a hay shortage. Last year, we had to, like, import from Arizona and New Mexico because there was no hay. And so our horses that are inside, they get, you know, 2 flakes and 1 of alfalfa. And it's like, yeah, that's not enough for being inside all day. And I mean, like, we have one mare in foal in right now because Sterling, our little Appaloosa colt, is his skin is pink. Like, aww. And I mentioned that at one point and everyone was like, just put a fly mask on him and sunscreen on his nose. And I was like, I don't think you understand. His entire body is pink. And so he doesn't have black skin like normal horses. And so he will sunburn everywhere. And it's too bloody hot here. And so they're inside during the day and they go out at night. And then our nurse mare, Irish, for Astro, she's in during the day because she stopped sweating. So we're like, oh, okay, man, can't kill the nurse mare. She has to, Astro's already lost one mom. Let's not lose two. No. And then we have the last one, Flit, is inside because of another point that I have later, that there's this idea of, you know, the special horses are the ones that get to stay inside. And I was definitely like that at one point. And then I sort of thought about it and I was like, okay, so why does Zoe get to stay inside, but no other horses get to stay inside? No other horses get blanketed. And like, what makes her different? Like, is she more fragile than anybody else? Or am I just being a helicopter mom? And it almost feels like you're less than or you're poorer if you can't afford to have your horse in a stall. And,
oh, yeah. They view it as, like, kind of, like, redneck, I've found.
Yeah.
Like, people assume that you can't ride or show well if you care for your horse in the way that's better for them.
I know. And I don't know what that – I mean, like, it's comparable to the positive reinforcement thing. It's like, oh, you're a pansy tree hugger. Oh, you consider the horse's emotions. LOL. Like, you.
Yeah, like, make fun of you for caring for your horse.
And
better.
You're like, how is that working in your brain up there? Like, don't get it. But, so some other things that I have on the list are like you said, circulation issues with stocking up. Then defecating in their water buckets. They're stuck laying in their shit if they want to lay down at night. Whereas outdoors, they typically choose a good spot. I mean, how many times have you watched a horse lay down? They're very picky. Some of them obviously wouldn't care.
And like the mud.
Yeah. But at least outside they have a choice. And, I also have, respiratory issues from ammonia and dust inhalation. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about that because, like I told you before I started recording, I did not read the studies that I was supposed to on that.
Well, and I think even, like, I'm pretty sure barn workers are more likely to have respiratory issues than anyone else because, like, hay dust is so bad to inhale. Like, I inhale it all the time because my horses eat, like, a really leafy alfalfa. And, like, if I sneeze after, I literally sneeze up, like, alfalfa.
Oh, I know. Every time I do stalls, I sneeze.
Ammonia is even worse. And even, like, most barns do not clean the stalls more than twice a day. And so if you consider that, like, horses pee a lot because they drink a lot of water. So they're probably standing, like, at least for 8 hours straight inhaling, like, their pee and, like, their poo particles and dust.
Well, and that's another thing, too. Some horses won't pee in a stall. And some horses won't use the bathroom at all in a stall. Flit, the Frisian sport horse that we have, when he's in a stall, he maybe poops once or twice. And sometimes he doesn't pee. I mean, like, and it's fantastic from a cleaning perspective. But not probably for his kidney function.
Oh, yeah, definitely. No, and you're probably uncomfortable for him too. That's sad.
Yeah. And I mean, I pick my battles, but, he's special. So he stays inside. And, I'm not trying to, you know, say anything bad about my boss. I love her endlessly. And I know that in her heart, she is trying to do the best thing for her horse. And that is something that I have not touched with her yet.
Yeah.
But, I don't know. She knows that I have differing opinions and she does, on a lot of things, but I just couldn't imagine. Cause I mean, when you clean stalls and you're like, oh my God, it is like ripe in here. And, I mean, like you said, nobody really stands around waiting for the horses to defecate or pee. And so they're standing with it all day long. And so it's, and I mean, like you said, I sneeze the whole time I'm cleaning stalls and I'm allergic to hay and grass. So it's not great for me in there either. But,
And it's weird because with horse trailers, it's kind of like a known thing that you got to clean out your horse trailer because the ventilation is not good in there and they'll be inhaling like their poo and pee. Mm-hmm. But like a stall is essentially the exact same thing as a horse trailer.
Yeah. And it's so funny how many different like the cognitive dissonances there are with that. But okay. So next question, are there any circumstances wherein you would be okay with stalling your horse?
If they're injured, like it's kind of like the lesser of two evils. If your horse has a tendon injury and the only way they can heal it is by being kept still, then that would be where I would stall it. But I would handle it a little differently than people who stall their horses all the time, because if the horse was getting really anxious and keyed up, I would probably give them a long-acting tranquilizer. Like, there's one that lasts for, like, 30 days. And I would do it for, like, for the duration of the stall rest period, or at least, like, a few months into it once they start getting really antsy.
Yeah, that's actually really interesting.
And handle it that way. But other than that, like, I don't think there's any reason for horses to be, like, stalled for basically the whole day unless they're injured.
Yeah, I mean, I'm right there with you. And it's funny because I also have hoof health written down here. And, you know, our farriers, we have horses, a few of them that have like really problematic feet for whatever reason. They're on the same food that everybody else is and everybody else is fine. But for some reason, there's like these select few that their bodies are just not making enough of whatever they need. And that is my next project, is diving into nutrition and finding out how to fix all of that, you know. Whatever.
Yeah.
But our farriers are always like, you know, you need to bring them in at least once a day so their feet can dry out if it's super wet outside. And but it's also interesting because I've been listening to the Humble Hoof podcast, and somebody on there, I forget which person Alicia was interviewing, but they were like, you know, it's when horses have like really bad hoof issues, keeping them inside sometimes is not always the best scenario or like the best thing you can do. Like when their hooves are healing from an injury or something, sometimes being outside is actually better for them because you're keeping that circulation going. And if you build a hoof based on a very fragile and safe environment, you don't really get something that can handle the real world, you know?
And that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I could not give that in technical terms or explain under which circumstances, which particular injuries that would be, you know, the best route, but it's something to consider and like talk to your vet and carrier about.
Yeah. And with the hoof thing too, I would say like in the long run, the way to handle that, that would be the best for the horse, I think, is really considering putting in a lot of money to get like good drainage and good footing, or building like a larger shelter and then putting their hay in the shelter where it's dry.
Mm-hmm.
And then they can stand in there for more of the day. I don't know. Cause like here, like it's hard cause it rains all the time. So we do get a lot of mud. But since it's a rainforest, like people literally couldn't turn their horses out for most of the time if they were trying to avoid it. So I think like obviously those things are expensive, so it's easier said than done.
Right.
But that would be the long-term goal. I think that should be for everyone if that's one of the problems that they run into.
Right. Well, and I mean like,
yeah.
If I saw, sorry, I just choked. I saw your post, about Milo's feet and his barefoot journey, and Zoe's journey has actually been like almost identical because her feet were getting really bad. And then I pulled her shoes, and I mean, I probably did not go about it in the best way because I didn't know what I was doing. I was just like, let's try barefoot. And that's what we did. And she actually like really was never sore. I mean, it was maybe like a day or two. You know, when she walked on rocks, she'd be really tenderfooted. And now she just like is, she has a huge hoof wall now. It looks like she has a shoe on. I mean, she's grown so much hoof, and her heels are still a little underrun, but like thoroughbred, but we're working on it. And my point in saying that is that like you live in a very wet environment and we get a lot of rain here too, but our horses' feet are still fine. So that's where I'm kind of like, it's not always the environment. I think it also like the horses that are having really like really bad problems out here, I think their bodies aren't getting enough of whatever they need to make their feet healthy. And because, I mean, you know, like you said, if the horses had to be inside to avoid the rain, you know, they would never. But both of our horses' hooves are proving that's not the case.
Well, with Milo especially, like, since his soles were so abnormally thin, like, the average horse my vet told me has, like, 15 to 20 millimeter thin soles, and his were 7.
Yeah.
So if he can do it, I do think that a lot of horses could, but I think that people lack the patience that it requires, because I did have to give him, like, 3 weeks to a month off.
Right.
But in the grand scheme of things, that's not very much. So
right. Well, and with Zoe, really too. Care. I mean, I wasn't riding her when I pulled her shoes, and that's pretty much why I did it. And, you know, when she would throw shoes, it would tear her feet up, and I was like, why do we even have them on? I'm not riding. And I know that, like, barefoot is not an option for everyone, and this is also not an episode on hoof health. I have one of those coming. I think it entirely depends on the horse and the circumstance and everything. But some other reasons that I have for being okay with stalling is quarantine. We've had
that makes sense.
I was just trying to like hit every bullet point because you know you know I get emails if I skipped a point. And then I wanted to ask your opinion about horses that are dealing with obesity and dry lotting and things like that. What do you think about that?
I don't think obesity would be a reason to stall because they would get less exercise. So I would say the solution for that would be a dry lot, or get a really good grazing muzzle, mm-hmm. and keep it on them all the time. Like, get one that they can drink out of and that they can wear comfortably all the time, and that it really limits their intake.
Yeah.
But that is a hard one. But in the long run, I do think that the horse isn't going to be happy long term if they're not out. So I would try to use every solution possible before stalling.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, next question. How do you feel about places that don't have a lot of land, like big cities?
Well, my opinion on that, because I've been asked this before, where someone is like, what if you can only have a horse stall 24/7 in your area, and people aren't going to like what I'm going to say.
I know, anyway. I'm kind of with you.
I think that if you want a farm animal that badly, and you do not live in a place that's suitable for a farm animal, then you need to move. If you want it badly enough, you'll move to accommodate the animal, because it's not fair to the horse to have to put up with completely neglectful circumstances, which would be stalling 24/7 is neglecting their need of freedom and forage and friends, all three of them. Yeah. Unless they get hay 24/7, but it's neglecting a pretty basic biological need for horses. So in my opinion, I don't think animals owe us being upset and stressed just so we can enjoy them. I think it's really selfish, and there's no way around that. It's selfish if they have to keep it in the city. I don't know. I lived in the suburbs, and there was no horse places where I lived initially before I moved. And I would drive 40 minutes to go to the barn.
Me too.
So I think either move or just get comfortable with traveling to go to the barn.
Yeah. And I mean, I hate to say it because I know it's going to upset a lot of people, because I mean, a lot of the responses that I got when I asked people what they thought about, stalling horses, that a lot of people were like, well, I live in an area where it's not an option for me to have my horse outside. So, we're all doing the best we can. And I agree to some extent, and I understand, but it should be a temporary situation, not you shouldn't get complacent with it. Because it's just not how horses are designed to live. They don't have very many basic needs. In actuality, they are very simple animals. They require less care and maintenance than cats and dogs do. I mean, you can just put them in a field and feed them. that's all you have to do. But they need buddies. They need space. They need food, shelter, and water. That's it. Yeah. It's the same.
I think the way to put it too is that I don't think anyone would want their dog or their cat living alone in a 12x12 room for the rest of their life. So I don't understand how we went so far wrong to be okay with it with horses. And I understand living in the city, and that some people might not want to move, but at the same time, you kind of have to choose what kind of lifestyle you want to live, because what I compared it to for people that were asking me about this last time was, I was if I lived in an apartment downtown, it doesn't matter how much I want a border collie or a blue heeler. It doesn't matter if they're my favorite breed. If I'm working a 12-hour day and I live in an apartment, why would I get a working dog? I shouldn't get it just because I want one. And if I got it anyways, people would be more likely to shame me for something like that than they would if I stalled my horse 24/7.
Yeah. And it's a double standard. We've talked about this several times now on this episode that it's not only a double standard between different animals, but also in different circumstances. When you go to a show, you're like, oh, I need to get my horse out of the stall and walk them around, because they're going to be in all day. But when they're in for, a half or three quarters that amount of time, normally when they're at home, you don't get them out and walk them. I mean, it's, I don't know. I tend to agree with you. And I'm kind of like, if you live in an area like that, take lessons. Don't buy a horse and bring a horse into that circumstance where they can't have buddies. They don't have access to free space. An hour a day or 30 minutes a day of arena turnout or hand walking is not enough. And it's
arena turnout is free lunging, in my opinion. You're just free lunging your horse. That's what it is.
Yeah. And also, most people don't want to hang around for the amount of time that the horse would need. And a lot of barns don't offer that because they have other horses that need to go out. And so, yeah. I mean, it's controversial, I'm sure, and it's going to upset and make some people feel guilty and bad about it. And that's not...
Well, I don't say it to guilt, and I know, like, it's impossible not to feel guilty, but I guess, like, the one thing that I think people need to consider is, because we all would consider ourselves horse lovers.
Exactly.
But if you're putting your own needs and wants, like, it's not a need. No one needs a horse. You want a horse for a personal enjoyment. It's a luxury item. Mm-hmm. And, well, not item. It's a luxury in your life. And that's great, but we can't claim to be loving our horses in the way so many people do if we're willing to put them in such a detrimental situation just so we can enjoy them.
Yeah, for so many reasons, too. I mean, we listed a ton above: health reasons, mental reasons, and, like, it's just not fair to the animal, and it is selfish. I agree, and I hate to say that because I know it's going to hurt some feelings, and that's not the goal. I mean, nobody is... We're not trying to shame anyone, I don't think. But it's something that needs to change, and it needs to be considered. And if people are going to start boarding facilities, they need to consider the basic needs of a horse. I mean, like, you can't start a boarding facility and not feed them or give them water. So why are we neglecting another basic need? Because it costs more. And, like, I mean, a lot of barns, you know, they do neglect the feed, and they feed shitty feeds like my last one did. And they also neglected the space. And it's just like... I think it's because the animal won't, or the chances are not, definitive that the animal will die if you don't have them or give them buddies or allow them space. But if you don't feed or, you know, water, they might. But, I mean, then you end up with horses like Zoe that, thank God we had insurance. Otherwise, she would be dead.
And the hard thing is, like, most of the worst problems related to stalling too much are mental. So they're not usually as blatantly obvious as it would be if your horse just suddenly turned into a skeleton.
Yeah. To the cognitive dissonance point, you can't look at your animal, say, I love it, keep it inside and watch it bob and weave, and, like, understand that that's a stressful behavior. The way to reduce the dissonance is to say that the horse is playing, or they're being silly, or they're goofy or neurotic or whatever. It's not a bad thing. Because if it was a bad thing, then you would have to face the reality that the animal is not happy. And you would
That's the thing. Like, I don't know. Like, people like that don't want to come to terms with it, they're more of a problem than people who have their horses in the same situation but know that it's a problem, because if you acknowledge it's an issue, you're more likely to try to take steps to make it better. Mm-hmm. But if you deny it, you're not. So, like, if anyone feels guilty, I would just say to do the best you can until you can find a better situation, and that you're being a good horse owner and doing better by your horse simply by acknowledging the problem in the first place.
Right. I mean, and you're probably going to take steps to, if it's stuck in the stall, to make that better and dedicate time out of your day, whether it's inconvenient or not, to have the horse, you know, hand grazing for hours. Like, you can't, you have to take on that responsibility. Like you said, if you got a really high energy dog breed, like I did with Mila, I had to let her out and I had to go sit outside with her and supervise for hours because I could not just leave her stuck inside all day. And it made me a real fuddy-dud at parties because I was like, I gotta go home, gotta take care of the dog. I'm like, can't leave her inside all day. So I think the next point I had was kind of like elaborating on 24/7 forage and turnout importance, because obviously we've been elaborating on turnout importance. You kind of can't talk about stalling without that. But 24/7 forage, I think, is a really big deal, because, like I said, most horses, they get hay in the morning, and then when they get turned out at night, they either get hay or they just have access to grass. So what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think boarding barns are the biggest problems with that, because most people that are on self-board and taking care of their own horses are less likely to do, like, the set feedings where it's like the horses get two flakes at this time, two flakes at this time, and two flakes here. And, like, the problem with that, too, is that the flakes aren't always going to be the exact same weight, so they're not always getting the same amount anyways.
Right.
But I don't like the set, like, feeding schedule where the horse has to go hours without being fed again. And like, even for fat horses, there's a lot of easier solutions to make sure that they have something to nibble on all the time without overfeeding them, because we have slow feed nets and, like, all sorts of things.
Yeah.
So I don't really think, like, even if boarding bars are trying to save money, there's no reason to make it a situation where the horses are going hours without anything to eat.
Right. Well, and I agree. I mean, I have, I know there's some argument on whether or not you should feed horses out of hay bags because it's up high and they have those, nets where you can, like, put whole bales in there. But I mean, if you had a horse with shoes, you wouldn't be able to do that because it's scary.
Yeah.
But Zoe, I have her, nibble net hanging outside. And she's the only horse that has a hay net, and it is the bane of the feed guy's existence.
Yeah.
We got into several arguments, and he was just, like, so not willing to do it, but now it's been long enough that it's just a part of the routine. But he was so frustrated that I wanted it in a net, but it makes – but, I mean, I have a horse that, you know, had colic surgery, and I don't know if you know about insurance, but if it's happened before, they don't cover it.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I guess it depends on the policy, but ours, like, she will never be covered for colic ever again. So I am taking every necessary precaution to prevent that from happening, including stopping competing, because my horse matters to me more than, you know, some ribbons and competitions that we lost anyway. But now she has the slow feed net because, not only does it save money, you might spend extra time, like I said, putting the hay net up and getting it clipped and shoving the hay in there, whatever. But you're going to end up saving a lot of money because the horses, I mean, every other paddock has a ton of, you know, hay on the ground or smushed into mud. Zoe's field, they eat.
Yeah, you save money.
Yeah.
So much money. Because I do hay nets all through the winter usually. Mm-hmm. And also, like, the difference a slow feeder makes, because I sometimes give my horses dry round bales because there's this guy that makes really nice, like, horse quality round bales. And I have a slow feed net for the round bales. If I put the slow feed net on the round bale, it lasts twice as long.
Yeah, and it's
significant.
And they eat every last bite. And they also eat longer than the others do. Especially, like, thoroughbreds seem to be really I don't want to say bad about doing it, but they tend to pee on hay, especially the ones that have stalls with straw. And
they're ungrateful because they've never starved a day in their lives.
Exactly. And so, like, when we have round bales in the winter, the horses, they just, when it breaks apart, they just end up pissing all over it. And I'm like, this is not a litter box, ladies. And it's unfortunate because we end up with big, you know, piles of or big, like, circles of dirt in the ground because the horses destroy the ground on the hay. And if we would put them in nets, but, you know, I mean, it takes extra time and nobody wants to do that, but it would save a ton of money.
It would save so much money,
And also it's better for the horses because they don't waste the hay, so they spend more time eating. And, you know, if it's on the ground in flakes, they walk on it, they pee on it, and then they don't eat all of it. So then they're like, okay, well, now I'm stuck without hay, you know? And the idea that, you know, they should just know not to do that. Well, it's an animal. It can't conceptualize.
They have no idea what they do.
Yeah, they don't have future. Oh, what is that? God, psychology major over here can't remember
foresight?
It.
No, that's.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah. I mean, they. It's more instant gratification, I guess. I'll just go with the opposite term. But
yeah, like, they can't know, like, oh, if I poo on this now, that means I won't get to eat it later.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
So I think now we can move into my common argument / devil's advocate section. So there are a few here. The argument that some horses just don't like stalling. Shelby, what do you think about that?
Am I supposed to do, like, a rebuttal on it?
Yes.
Okay. So some horses just don't like turnout, was it?
Yeah.
Okay.
They just
so
don't like. Or,
no horse. Yeah. Like, okay, they might dislike turnout. But it's not because they're just going, huh, like, I'd rather not go outside. It's because you've put them in such a stressed out state. They have Stockholm syndrome.
Yeah.
You've put them in a stall and they've gotten used to being enclosed in a small area, 4x4 walls, or not, like, 4 walls all attached. They
it's their perception of safety.
Horses. They definitely can't trot around. It's usually quieter in a stall, and then you throw them out in a situation all at once when they don't get any exercise other than riding, and then you just expect them to be calm. It's not fair to the horse.
Mm-mm.
So for that situation, like, I would say the easy solution for people who have horses that are stressed like that is to, first and foremost, put them out with a quiet buddy, like a quiet horse that's not going to go running around with them if they get stressed. And secondly, constant forage. And then if they're still stressed, then you start the turnout in smaller, like smaller increments.
Well, and
make
even
it
then,
highly rewarding to be out there.
Right. And even then, I mean, you could start so small as like just hand walking the horse and then start turning out in the arena for longer periods of time and longer periods of time and then work up to going out with a buddy, like you said, that's calm for a short amount of time, bring him back in and then just work up to it and make it a really rewarding experience with, you know, friends that are nice and not going to beat them up and food that they really enjoy. Maybe start feeding them outside so that they really look forward to going outside. I mean, there's so many things that you could do. I mean, if you can train a horse, a naturally claustrophobic animal, to enjoy being on a on a trailer and loading by themselves, like, you can absolutely train a horse to enjoy something that they're biologically designed to desire.
Yeah, that's the thing. Naturally, no horse would enjoy being in a stall because as a flight animal, it's more dangerous. And then I guess the other argument I would have against that is if you throw a horse outside, they're stressed, and then you say they don't like it, you better have the same energy towards your riding. When they refuse to jump, they don't like jumping. Stop jumping them because most people in that case, they would put the work in to fix it. Training-wise, if you're not going to put the same work in to make them comfortable in their off time, then you're super selfish.
Exactly, because one is self-serving. You want to do the jumping, and you're driven and motivated, so you're going to make it happen. But, you know, you're not going to work with the same amount of energy and motivation to give your horse its basic needs. I mean, I agree. And I was going to make that point earlier, but I couldn't figure out how to articulate it, so I just skipped it.
It's so sad because, like, if you think about it, like, the horses will go out to the arena and they'll jump over stuff and do stuff that's so unnatural for their nature. And then their owners that use that excuse don't even have it in them to give them comfort in their off time between rides.
Yeah, I completely agree. So I think that's that one argued. So the argument that it keeps them safer and healthier looking, I feel like this might be a smidgen redundant, but who knows? You might say something like you just did.
I would say like they might get less like superficial scratches. Like they're probably more likely to get little cuts and abrasions in the field. But like, honestly, I've seen way more horses die from colics and like being cast and stuff like that than I ever have from accidents out in the field. And also riding them is dangerous. So again, like same thing as the last argument, if you're okay with endangering them to go do your horse shows and ride around on them, then you should care even more about doing something that's for their well-being.
I completely agree. Okay, another question that I have that I just thought of, which do you think is better, either keeping horses in a barn where they can touch other horses, either through the bars or like see them outside of their doors, or being in a paddock in isolation?
I think they'd probably prefer to be in the barn where they could all interact with each other. Mm-hmm. And like, there are some really neat barns. I think they're mostly in Europe where they set up, like the stalls are all open and the horses are inside. They're in a barn and there's like shavings everywhere, but they're all together and they have space.
I haven't seen that.
That's open
so awesome.
Concept barns.
It's like a big arena, I guess.
That's
super dope. And I prefer the stalls because I thought you were gonna say the ones that just kind of have like kind of a border pin kind of thing, like kind of like a, what do you call it, like a puppy whelping station. Like where they don't have bars or walls or anything. And I mean, I could see where that would be problematic, but I think that's way better because they could groom and interact with one another than because, I mean, it's all about us, frankly. I mean, we're trying to keep them safe and from injuring themselves when, you know, you won't even take the step to see if that would work, if they could learn to be comfortable with that, like being outside.
Oh, for sure. Well, and even the issue of, like, a lot of people say they don't want bars between the stalls or don't want the stalls to be lower so that they could groom each other because their horses will fight. Mm-hmm. But all of that food aggression and aggression to other horses is part of the problem.
Yeah,
you know,
it comes
like
from
a horse that
stalled.
Grows up in a herd, they're not going to have the same level of problem sharing food. And like, Milo's food aggressive, but he was starved, so it's understandable.
Right.
And, like, he's gotten better the more he's been out with other horses, and the more he's realized that he's just going to get fed all the time and that they always have hay. It's gotten better. But at its core, the reason why horses are aggressive like that, especially to the point where you actually have to worry about having a half stall because you think it's dangerous, it's because of the situation that they have been put in by people.
Right. Completely agree. Okay, so I guess, like, the last one was something that we kind of touched on. The idea of elitism, that it's somehow better or you care more about your horse. I guess it's kind of like performative activism where you, like, it's like, look how nice I'm taking care of my horse. He gets to stay inside in a nice, snuggly, clean stall versus being outside. And it's, like you said, hillbilly or redneck. Yeah. To keep them out all the time. And I had to fight against that too, and I'm sure you did to some extent. When I decided to move Zoe to 24/7 turnout, everybody was kind of like, why? And I was like, I mean, at the time, that was when I was like getting a lot of hate for positive reinforcement, because it's kind of hard to say, I'm switching to this training method, but I don't think it's better than your method. Like, because obviously I do. Otherwise, I wouldn't be. And I tried to use that argument so much to save my own ass, and it does not work. But I mean, it's the same thing with turning out. Like, obviously, I think it's better because that's what I'm choosing to do for my horse. And I mean, obviously, depends on the horse, but I think turnout pretty much goes for every horse there is. And I don't know.
Elitism is, like, so ingrained in the horse world, and I think that's also partly why, like, people fought your transitioning to training methods so much, and it's also why people fight other, like, science-based training methods and, like, studies, like the turnout stuff. They do it because they don't want to change their ways, and it is a selfish thing. Like, they're doing it to protect themselves from having to adopt a new lifestyle, and I found it, like, it's so ingrained to the point where, like, I've had people, like, make fun of me for not having, like, a fancy, like, fancy, like, my barn is not fancy. It's not fancy here. It's just, like, regular.
Yeah, it's either.
And I've had people make fun of me for that and be like, oh, like, you're at your, like, oh, dinky little, like, barn with, like, stuff sitting out, and there's, like, not nice stuff. Like, it's not a fancy barn, but
it's not the priority.
It's all safe. The horses get to go out. All of them have constant access to a paddock. Other than stall resting horses, there's no horses that can't walk outside from their shelter.
And I agree.
It's set up better for the horses. And I've even had people say things like, if I don't inject my horses, then I'm not caring for them as much. And it's all so skewed, because if your horse needs injections, it means that they've been worked in a manner that has worn their joints to the point where they need injections. And I'm not saying injections are bad, but they shouldn't be, like, viewed as, like, you're better if your horse needs injections.
Right. Well, and that's where I'm at with, like, you know, Zoe got diagnosed with kissing spine, and I did inject her hocks because that's what I thought the issue was. But believe it or not, those two things tend to go together. She has hock problems because she has kissing spine, and she's not using her back, and therefore using her hocks in a way that she's not designed to. But kissing spine, like, you know, a lot of people were like, why aren't you getting the surgery to fix it? You can literally fix it. But, like, the surgery is either having somebody go sand down the bones in her back or cut a ligament in her back. Like, I was like, I don't know about that. I'm going to have to think on that one.
Yeah.
And my vet was like, oh, yeah.
It's so expensive. Plus, if the spinal processes have worn down each other, the surgery doesn't always work. Like,
right.
I don't remember what they said the success rate is, but it's not as high as you would want it to be for how risky it is and how much it costs.
Well, and here's the thing too with that is it's the same point that we're both making about stalling and horses that are uncomfortable being outside. It takes more work to get there, but the correct way to fix kissing spine is not to do the surgeries. The surgeries may help, but you're going to end up with a similar problem, because the fundamental error is that the horse has been carrying itself wrong, whether it's due to genetics or conformation or just bad training. Mine, I think Zoe's built pretty well. I mean, she's got a shark fin with her, but I'm not entirely sure that that has anything to do with kissing spine. But she carried herself wrong for so long because I was under trainers that didn't, you know, we didn't have a hyper focus on long and low and building a top line properly from the ground and then getting on. So, I mean, now I can't get on her because, and I refuse to use lunging aids because it, having that tension. And this is the whole point, is those shortcuts screw everything up. So when you put lunging aids on, the horses brace against them. and then they get tied in their back, which prevents them from building the muscles that they need to help their spine out. And that is a whole lot harder because you have to learn how to do it properly. And that's why I've been avoiding it personally, because you have to learn how to do it first, because you can't use those tools. And also you can't just rely on the surgery to fix the problem because the horse is still going to be carrying itself incorrectly.
And yeah, that's the thing. Like the surgery, you could just screw it up again if you don't rehab the horse properly. And yeah, that's the problem I have with gadgets. Like I will use side reins when I'm lunging sometimes, but I don't use them tightly. And also the horse needs to still have a basic concept of softness before you put them on. Like I would never put them on a horse that braces because it's not going to teach them anything. Right. And then with like under saddle aids, like draw reins and all this stuff, at their core, they're all about just forcing the horse into a certain frame before they're ready to do it.
Right. And it's about getting that end result without teaching the animal how to get there. And that's what I like about the positive reinforcement. You work in successive approximations, and it's a lot harder to jump to the end result with that. And because I have a tendency to just want to get to the end goal behavior. I mean, I think we all do to some extent. And so when I use negative reinforcement, I'm a lot more likely to try and push the issue. And so that's why positive reinforcement is so important to me. And it's better for me because, you know, I mean, you can think logically and, intelligently that you want to do it a certain way, use positive reinforcement XYZ, but I also use it as a preventative because I know myself and I know that I'm going to rush it and try to get somewhere, you know, quicker than I need to. And it's a lot harder for me to do that in positive reinforcement, but it's the same concept that it's just, it's a lot easier to take the shortcuts and just validate it and be like, oh, well, you know, this is the easier way. This is the best way. And we end up elevating the shortcuts to some sort of elitism. Like everybody always says you should only ride in draw reins if you have fantastic hands. Well, everyone wants to ride in draw reins to prove that they can have, or that they have fantastic hands.
And I think if you have good hands, you shouldn't be draw reins.
I completely agree. I kind of have the same stance on certain bits, like gag bits. I'm like, bro, if you have to use a certain level of equipment, I'm kind of on the opinion, I mean, it's an unpopular opinion. I don't know if you're going to agree with it or not, but if you have to use a piece of equipment that has that high of a propensity for damage, then why are we pushing the issue? Maybe change disciplines, do something else. You don't have to compete.
Teach the horse better flat work so they relax. Yeah. Okay. I would agree with you there, though. I think they need to have more regulations for show jumpers, especially.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure we'll get into that on your episode all about
the. Oh yeah, that one will be a doozy because there's so much.
Oh, I know. Well, and do you know that Anchor has like a time limit? Like your file can't be super big.
Really? Yeah. No, I did not know that.
I think, I can't remember what my longest one is, but I try to keep it under 2 hours. And even when I do 2 hours, sometimes I have to make it a not as high quality file. But nobody on the podcast needs to know that. I can text you about it.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, but because, I mean, I could talk about stuff like this forever. But do you have anything else to say about the elitism thing, or do you want to move on to listener questions?
The last thing I will say is that I think, like, at its core, a lot of the ways we train and keep horses are selfish and about instant gratification for us. And I think that competition, I don't think competing horses is inherently wrong, but the problem with it is that it creates a certain drive to get to a certain point, and you start comparing yourself to others inevitably, and it makes you want to rush things, which makes you more predisposed to starting to do things that are unfair to the horse and justifying them. Right. And I think that's the main problem, like with the turnout thing, is that people are valuing their own ease of living or what they feel most comfortable with personally above what their horse would be most comfortable with.
Right. And I think it's interesting because the whole time you were saying that, I was wondering if you're going to say something about rushing young horses too. And I was like, and here's our preview on your episode, for your podcast, which I also should probably mention listeners out there. I'm also going to do an episode on Shelby's podcast where we talk about pretty much all things young horses. But it's interesting that it's kind of a pervading theme, like throughout every aspect of horse training. Because I mean, I thought you were going to go in that direction and you went in the stalling turnout direction. And it's just applicable everywhere.
It's all connected because I find that a lot of the people who are most inclined to use a lot of training aids or bigger bits are also the same people that don't want to turn out their horses.
Right. Yeah. And they're usually the people that depend on the horses for finances and supporting them. and they're their business, so they got to get the horse to a top level fast enough, but people don't realize that those horses are the ones that break down.
Oh, for sure. Patience is key with horses. Mm-hmm.
Slow and steady wins the race. We learn nothing from the turtle and the hare.
Yeah.
Or tortoise. Whatever. Fuck it. Okay. So now I think we can move into listener questions, yeah?
Okay, perfect.
Okay, so some of these aren't actually questions, and they're just like, talk about it. So let me attempt to make sure that I'm not being super redundant. So the first one, like stalling and its relation to injury rates and creating fragile horses. I mean, I think we pretty well touched on that.
One thing that I can add about that that someone told me at the racetrack that I found quite interesting is apparently North America is the only area where racehorses are kept at the track in stalls, and everywhere else they haul horses in, and a lot of them turn
Go
them
figure.
Out more. And we also have the highest rate of breakdowns in North America. So I think that it's all connected for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that definitely makes sense. And I mean, it's all the, I just think America is, well, North America, I guess, because you don't live in the States. But I mean, the UK, if I'm not mistaken, just recognized horses and some other animals as sentient beings. And
oh my God, they're not recognized as that yet?
No, they're livestock still in America. Oh. I mean, how else would we have a horse slaughter industry? If they're sentient beings, you can't kill them. Like,
oh my God.
Yeah. So it's like, and I mean, you know, the UK has whisker rules, and they have so many more laws in place about the welfare and treatment of animals that we just don't have in the US because of the shortcuts and the, you know, aesthetics of everything. And it's nicer to have your horse scratch free and with a shiny coat, which often they end up being dingy if they're super stressed out anyway. But you know, keeping them in stalls for you know, aesthetics and selfish reasons.
Yeah, it's a big problem here. North America, I think we just view ourselves as like the center of the earth too, so it's hard to take in what other areas are doing better than
yeah
us.
Well, and I always say, like, I would so love to, like, at least spend some time over in the UK and, like, Germany. Germany tends to be, like, really progressive. I see so many people, like, that, like, their competitions allow you to ride bridleless and tackless.
That's so cool. I wish they, I asked a lady at, like, Southlands, a local show place here, about that, and she was so mean to me and, like, basically said I was stupid, and I was like, there's literally no rule against this. They just told me it was steward's discretion, and then she was so unkind, and I was like, wow.
Yeah.
So you're allowed to go into the arena with a double twisted wire gag, but I can't take my horse in bridleless. Okay.
Dude, don't even get me started. I mean, I have so much to say on that, and I'm sure it'll come up in the
young horse one we can talk about all
yeah
of that.
I'm trying to keep on topic, no tangents.
Yeah.
But I also have some episodes planned on, I want to do like a, I'm planning to do another controversial tag talk
okay.
YouTube video, because I don't know, it's been a few years since I posted the last two, and I don't agree with half of the shit I said.
Yeah.
So and I know
those
you recently
are always
did
fun.
One.
People get so mad.
Yeah, I watched yours recently because I wanted to make sure that I wasn't going to miss anything. But then I actually have already filmed it, and it ended up being like 2 hours long. And I was like, all right, we're going to have to redo that and find out what's important. But yeah, I am planning on doing a podcast more in depth on it as well. And I'm sure I'm going to piss some people off because my views are not what they used to be. And I used to always get people saying, like, oh, my God, I love everything you have to say. You're so middle of the road. And I was like, yes, because I'm pandering, because I'm a child and I don't know how to have an opinion. I'm afraid of other people disagreeing with me. But I think this episode is taking a step for sure in the direction of I care more about welfare than I do about, you know, people's opinions.
Yeah, that's the thing. And honestly, the reactions I've noticed, because what I do when I talk about turnout is I always am careful to only do it on my own social platforms or in group conversations where they invite opinions.
Yeah.
I would never go comment on someone's post where their horse is stalled and be like, hey, screw you.
Right.
But
if anything, you're just going to
still get
push
mad
them away.
Even when I stay in my lane. And I've noticed that a lot of the people react very violently and like unkindly, like the stuff people have done to me over like this, the welfare stuff I've talked to is like ridiculous.
Yeah.
And I think it says something about like that level of selfishness and the type of behavior it breeds in
right
people.
Well, and I mean, it's the baseline behavior for all of that is fear. You're afraid, because recognizing that you might be right means that everything that they've done is wrong, and now they have to face shame and guilt, and also this wildly overwhelming road ahead of how to, like, you know, fumbling
how
through how to change it. Yeah. And that's why I think positive reinforcement pissed so many people off, because it was like, oh my God, like, you know, this equestrian that had been so middle of the road and only ever posted about, you know, competitions and, you know, the normal things, popular opinions. And I just agreed with everyone pretty much. And if I didn't, I was like, ah, I'm just not going to talk about that one. You know, I mean, it's, I don't know.
Yeah, and it's the thing for those people too, is that they deter people from speaking out, because they handle the disagreement by just trying to make the other side out to be stupid,
right,
even if the other side has the most credible information.
And they're often the loudest ones, because they have the most reason to argue, and the people that tend to agree or are sort of in agreement tend to not say anything, because they're like, I'm not really sure where I stand. So then you end up feeling like everybody is against you, and so definitely been
there. Oh, for sure.
It
makes it so hard to talk about anything, because people are just so aggressive, no matter how you say it. And, like, I don't know. I state things often pretty bluntly in writing and without tone, so people always assume I'm just, like, being a dick, and I'm just like, no, like, I just don't want to add, like, emojis and extra flour to, like, my post when I don't have to.
I definitely still do that, because I am people pleaser at heart, but it's I understand where you're coming from. And also, like, I get so annoyed in the podcast and videos when I catch myself being like, okay, well, I don't want to offend anybody. Okay, well, I'm not saying this. And, like, I feel like I have to cover every fucking variable to make sure that I'm not pissing anybody off. And I'm like, can it just be understood that I'm not trying to personally attack anyone? And
you. Well, and if welfare discussion pisses you off, like, are you really looking out for your animal's best
Exactly.
interest?
And if it doesn't apply to you, I'm not talking about you.
Oh, exactly. Like, so many people are like, oh yeah, well, like, my horse goes out, and they're like, okay, congrats. Like, I don't even know who your horse is. Why would I be referencing you?
Yeah. And beyond that, like, if you're mad, then you should probably take a look at it, you know?
Yeah. No kidding, because then you feel targeted in some way. It doesn't matter how much or how little it applies. If you get upset about it, it's because you feel threatened.
Right. And
yeah.
We're both, like, getting heated about that. So much PTSD around internet drama. But, okay, so I think that one's about getting injured. Oh, wow. I definitely use Siri on this. If you had to stop for at least part of the day, how long do you think would be acceptable to stall?
If I had to stall for at least part of the day, I wouldn't want my horse stalled for longer than they're out in the paddock. So I think I'd only want them stalled for, like, up to 8 hours a day. I'd probably want it similar to what people view as acceptable for dogs. And I think it's 8 hours that they say no more than 8 hours in the kennel.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
So I'd say the same for horses.
Yeah. I still, like, I mean, I'm sure you feel similarly. Like, I just, like, thinking about putting Zoe back in a stall, like, gives me, like, instant anxiety. I'm like, oh my God, she'd be so stressed. Like,
well, and 8 hours is such a long, like, Milo, honestly, if he had been stalled long-term when I got him, he would be one of the horses that people would want to euthanize for aggression. Cause even when we had to put him on paddock rest for his injury, like, several years ago, he was so mean to everybody.
Oh my God, that's how Bro was.
Yeah, like, awful, like, so unhappy, and then it came out in aggression to other people.
Yeah. Well, and when I had my last horse, Bo, he had keratoma removal surgery, so they literally, like, his bone was exposed on his hoof. They had to, I mean, we had to take him to Oklahoma, and they had to cut it out, and it was a whole issue. And he was on stall rest for 6 months.
Oh my God.
And I think I started riding him in month 8, but I mean, he had to grow his entire hoof out, because if he got anything in it, he could have gotten an infection, and then he would have been dead. And so it was so brutal. He was such an asshole. Like, the stalls, it was that barn that had the cinder block stalls, and they had some wood panels, and, like, the back of the door was wood, and, like, there were teeth marks. It looked like there was a bear in there, because he was he just, like, clawed it with his mouth. Like, he just ate the stall apart, and he didn't crib, but he would just, like, scrape the fuck out of the wood, and he would kick the stalls. Anybody that tried to clean, he was just aggressive. And I mean, like, I had stall guards up because I wanted him to have some like freedom. And but I mean, I was a kid and I didn't want to walk him every day. I mean, like, I would get him out for 20 minutes and then put him back up, and I mean, that was super shitty. And now I'm like, I couldn't imagine doing that. But yeah, so I mean, it's just lazy and selfish, and I couldn't even imagine putting Zoe in now. She gets to stay outside, and if she wants to be in a shelter, she is more than welcome. But yeah, I think that question's pretty well answered.
Yeah.
So how to safely stall a horse that needs to be on stall rest but has always been in a pasture? So I guess nice segue there.
I would give them lots of toys and like enrichment. Constant hay in a hay net. And also, like, if they, like I said, if they get really worked up, what I would do is I'd do a long acting tranquilizer. I don't remember what the drug is called.
Yeah, I didn't know that was a thing.
But there's one that lasts for like a month.
Yeah, that's wild. I had no idea that was a thing, and I'll definitely keep that in mind. I'd have to see if it's like legal in America, because sometimes it's different, but I've definitely
I'll ask what it's called, because I know that like racehorses that were rehabbing injuries from the track, they would use it on some of them.
Yeah, because I mean, I've had horses on stall rest, and I've never had a vet mention that to me. And everyone in my area, when they've had horses that have been nutso on stall rest, they end up like acing them. And
ace is not a good
and it's really annoying, like, because I mean, if they're already jazzed up and you give them ace, it just makes it worse. And the thing is too, it was funny because I just hadn't even considered that this was a thing, but we had Astro. He's our 3-month-old warm blood colt, and he is the mouthiest motherfucker on the face of the earth. He, like, he's, like, bitten me a few times, but it's never a bite. It's just kind of a pinch. Yeah, well, not even that. Like, he got my whole bicep in his arm, like, 2 days ago, and it just felt like he touched me. And I was like, thank you, horse gods, for not making me lose a chunk of my bicep. But so he's super mouthy. So I told Sonny to get him a Jolly Ball with like a little handle, because I thought he would be all over that shit. And he was like, he had no idea how to use it. And I think people think that the horses will just pick it up, and they don't. You have to teach them how to use it, unless you do like enrichments, like putting hay in a, like in an old Amazon box or something. A lot of people do that, where they have to kind of like dig around in it, and it stimulates foraging, not stimulates. But yeah, so there are things like that, but also with toys, like a lot of horses, they get those, they look like apples, and you put those, tasty fillers in there. Which full of sugar. And also both of my Zoe and previous horse Bo would eat them in one night, so kind of
my old Arab the purpose used to do that.
Yeah, and so, and then they don't play with the ball, and so I mean, like, I think people give kind of like a half-ass effort. They're like, oh, this is good enough, he has a ball in there, he just doesn't play with it. And then they blame the horse, like, no, you have to teach it how to do that. It's not in their natural ethogram behavior repertoire to play with balls. Okay, let's move on. Okay, so this one, I don't know if you have any like research on it, but does keeping a horse in a stall for the majority of the day negatively affect hooves and overall health? I mean, I think we pretty much, I mean, I don't have any like statistics or anything on hooves that I think talked about.
It definitely impacts it negatively impacts their health for sure, because like I said earlier, like the stall vices, and like they call it stereotypical behaviors in science, like weaving, cribbing, they're all called that, and they basically only exist in stalled horses. And like they came about from us stalling horses and the stress that we inflict on horses. So that would be mental, like, poor health.
Yeah.
And then the physical poor health would be the lack of circulation, the respiratory issues. And yeah, I'd say the mental health though is the one where people see it the most obviously, but they will try to often mislead people why the behaviors exist.
Yeah. And I mean, it goes back to the cognitive dissonance. And you know, it's actually really interesting, because when I asked on Instagram about the stalling and what people thought, and people brought up the respiratory issues, I had never even considered that. And I mean, I'd seen people saying like you need to put lime over the urine spots or let it air out for a while so it doesn't get too bad, but I just never really considered like the distinction between, because like I guess let me make a distinction here. There was this Instagrammer a while back, like this was years ago, and she used to train her horse to smile by using ammonia, and that's actually pretty common. And
wow.
Like, let's not, because it makes the horse do the phlegmon or however the hell you pronounce it.
Oh my
that.
God.
Do you know how to pronounce that by chance?
Yeah, I call it phlegmon. Okay. Yeah, phlegmon.
I'm like, flamin'.
Or just smiley lip.
Yes. So when they lift their lip up to smell better, you can teach them to smile that way. And she was doing that, and she got hella hate for that. I mean, like, people called the animal services on her.
Oh my
and,
God.
It was a whole ordeal, but then you do the same thing and it's obviously not as concentrated as it would be in a cup, but like, it's pretty much the same. I mean, you
it would add up
stalls.
Like over the hours that they're exposed to it though. So it's kind of ironic that
yeah.
people throw a fit over that, but
exactly. It's what you're talking about. Like, you know, the distinction between horses and dogs, it's double standard, because one is self-serving and one is not. okay. So do stalls with runout give a significant improvement over stalls with no turnout in terms of quality of life?
I don't think they've specifically studied in-and-out stalls, but they did do a study on stall bars and, like, horses being able to see out and interact with other horses, and it did make a significant difference. So I would assume in-and-outs would be the same, but honestly even better because they'd have more movement.
Yeah. Okay, so what to do, this one's like kind of like a, I guess a personal, what do I do if I have a horse that, I absolutely have to put on stall rest and he's very anxious. He paces so much that his stall is mud. I'm guessing like I would assume they don't know about the long acting tranquilizers, and I'm sure that's what, but in the event that that is not legal in America, like what would you suggest outside of like enrichment?
I would look into, like, some of the more potent calming supplements mm-hmm. and see, like, what ones are the best ones on the market right now that you can feed daily.
Yeah.
And then the other thing would just be, if he's not already getting free choice hay, I would get him a slow feed net and give him free choice hay. And if he's able to eat stuff like alfalfa, you could give that to him because it's a little bit coarser. So if you mix that with the grass hay, it'll take him a little longer to get through it. And typically horses really like the taste of alfalfa, so it'll keep him busier. And then if there's any way to make it so he can see other horses in the stall if he can't already, that'll help. Or if there's any way to take like the window down so he can at least stick his head out and look out, that generally helps as well. And then obviously if you're allowed to hand walk him, just hand walk him for as long as you can each day.
Yeah. And I think also too with that, like damn it, I tried to stutter so I can get back to my thought. It left. Shit, I hate when this happens. See, this is normally at the point where, like, if I'm filming, I'll just, like, take a break and, like, rewind and listen.
Yeah.
But I was going to say something else. Ugh, I totally forgot. Oh, I was going to say something about, like, if you're concerned about gaining weight by having hay all day long. Obviously, the slow feed net should help, but at the same time, like, you can adjust the grain accordingly because, in my opinion, it's much better to just do an all forage diet with choice minerals. And if you have to give them a certain supplement, like you said, if you have to give long-acting supplements for calming, to mix them with just a little bit of food and try to reduce the what do they call it? Like, I have the word commercial and condensed stuck in my head. I know it's
concentrates.
Yes. And reduce that. I think that's kind of a general rule, but
yeah, I'm actually trying to switch my horses completely over to hay pellets so I can let people know if it works because
yeah,
see,
I think that would be really interesting. I know,
but
when
I would pull them off, like if they're on stall rest, I would give them as little grain as possible personally because it keeps them pent up and then
yeah. And also grain. And grain, like, most people feed, like, oh my God, one of the horses that we had here, he was so thin when he came to us, but he was so prone to ulcers. And so we got this feed, I forget exactly what it was, but it was specifically designed for underweight, ulcer-prone horses. And when I started doing the minimal looking into nutrition that I did, it had, like, almost a 10% sugar in it, and I was like, what the hell? I was like, the horses' bodies are not designed to process near that amount, and it's a guarantee for ulcers. And I was like, how on earth are we, you know,
I think it's because boarding barns, honestly. Like, if more people had to learn about the actual day-to-day, like you would with a dog or a cat, you know?
100%.
Like, you're in charge of your dog or cat's nutrition directly, and I don't know. I think it would be better if, like, when people first started taking lessons, if they actually learned more about, like, equine behavior and nutrition. And,
yep. I said the same thing.
Like you said, like, sugar also wrecks their feet. So that's why so many thoroughbreds on the racetrack have such bad feet and thin soles.
Oh my God, I know. Me and Sunny were just talking about that. It's atrocious. The ones that we get off the track are just like, oh my God, it takes forever to get their feet back. And I think too, there's another kind of like, you know, people have the conspiracies about the pharmaceutical companies. Like, do they really help you or are they trying to sell? And so when you market a feed for horses that are ulcer prone to help them, it doesn't really do you a whole lot of good to fix the horse, you know, that has ulcers, because then you stop selling that feed. Like,
yeah, exactly.
And also, like, it blows my mind, because I would also like to just kind of do a ration balancer and the vitamins and minerals and whatnot, and just do like just a pretty strict hay diet. And I'm sure when I have my own place, that's probably what I'm going to end up doing. But here I don't have full say, and I'm pretty happy with the feed, and Zoe doesn't get very much. Just enough to feel like she's participating in breakfast.
Yeah. They're not feeling left out.
Right. And but yeah, I think it's that elitism too. Like, oh, my horse gets the fanciest feed that money can buy. And he gets this amount and these supplements. I'm doing so much. Look how much I'm doing for my horse. And it feels wrong to not, but it's more natural and it's actually better for them to do that. But the feed companies, you know, are the ones that fund the studies, and they're biased, and they want you to believe that your horse needs their feed. Otherwise, they would be out of business.
Yeah, and then they sponsor trainers, too. So then the trainers are selling the product, too.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, even at the upper levels, I think the main thing that people need to start realizing, too, and this goes into the stalling debate, because a lot of the upper level riders are guilty of stalling too much. I think more people need to realize that someone being an Olympian, riding like five-star eventing, showing a Grand Prix, whatever, it doesn't mean they actually know anything relevant about equine behavior and like how to properly care for them in terms of like feed and like turnout and stuff. Like, you can be an excellent rider and you can train horses up to that level all while taking advantage of them and not taking fair care of them.
And most of the time it comes from circumstance. And people always say, like, back in the day, well, I didn't have all the money. I just was hard work and blood and sweat and tears. But the opportunities were different back then, number one. And showing and competing was not as expensive as it is today. And also, like, people get different lots in life. And I mean, if you just end up with the right trainer and get going, then I mean, you don't have to learn. And you can just, like, do everything that you've been taught. Sorry, I'm playing with a tripod thing because...
Oh, no worries. Fidget. Well, and if you're a new rider, you also don't know where to even start. So you're so likely to get taken advantage of. Mm-hmm. And, like, the fact of the matter is, most of the barns that appeal to beginning riders are the exact ones that will teach you, like, at least one bad thing. Maybe lack of turnout, blessed horses in saddles that don't fit, that are ulcer ridden and not happy.
Right.
Or there'll be something, because most of the places are like that, and there's not the same emphasis on like equine behavior and proper animal husbandry in the horse world as there should be.
Right. And with dogs, like you said, when you have primary control over their care, you're probably going to put time into going to puppy classes and maybe reading a book or two and making sure that you ask your vet and make sure you're feeding the best feed you can your animal. But
well, and the other thing that I've noticed too is that, like, since I live on the same property with my horse, like, I can see them out of my bedroom window.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of boarders will claim, like, oh, my horse doesn't do anything in turnout, he doesn't play, like, he doesn't like it, there's no point in him going out. They'll say things like that from the mere few hours that they're at the barn. If you actually sit here all day, like, they'll lay down numerous times, they'll be playing, and they'll have like little kind of running arounds and scoots, or like just play, like standing still and nipping at each other and just playing that way, or hanging out all together and eating hay together. Like, they do lots of stuff, and I don't think people realize how much they actually move around. And like I said, my field's not as big as I would want it to be, but they're busy. Like, they're going to check stuff out. Like, when they're at the bigger field, they'll nap at the top of the hill, then they'll go to their hay, then they walk all the way down to the end to just stare at the cows that the neighbor has, and then they run back. And they do all sorts of things. Like, I think people not being around to see how their horses might be lethargic and depressed in their stall, or how they might have really obvious stall vices that extend for hours and they might not be aware of that. You don't notice those things unless you're at the barn all the time, right.
And beyond that, like what we were saying about the professional aspect, there is a motivation to, promote a certain way of treating horses. And that's where you get the boarding barns where, like you were saying about the lessons, you often get taught, you know, ponies are just grumpy because that's their personality. And, oh, the saddle doesn't really need to fit. Because if it did, then you wouldn't have a clientele because it'd be like, you're abusing your animals.
And it also costs money to, like, get your saddle fit and make sure your ponies are happy right. and not in pain.
And people have to realize
they want to make money.
It's a business, and that doesn't mean the information is factual. And just because an upper-level rider does it and they aren't showing you the issues that they're running into doesn't mean that it's the best way to do it. And I cannot stand people being like, well, look at the 5-star event riders. They use X amount of equipment or do this and that. And I'm like, all right. But that to me, that doesn't justify because I'm like,
anything because they're still being unfair to the horse, like at the end of the day. And, like, this is obviously not, like, the greatest comparison because this thing that I'm going to say is way more serious than what's going on with the horses. But we're learning right now in the world about, like, how big this human trafficking ring is in North America and how many high-profile people have been involved. It's not that hard to think that there'd be lower-scale things like this happening in the horse world where they're doing unfair things to the horses and either covering it up or teaching people that it's okay so no one questions them because it makes them money and they can produce horses quicker, churn them out more, and if you can stable more horses on your property and have less turnout pens, you got more money from training horses and boarding horses.
Exactly. And the horses that are the ones that get rushed and pushed through the training are the ones that, you know, they're doing that because they need to be sold and because the trainers don't make money otherwise because their entire business is selling horses based on their name. And if they're not competing at those upper levels, they don't have a name and they don't have a business. And but that doesn't mean that those like I was saying about gag bits and certain pieces of equipment, I'm like, if you have to use that, maybe we don't need to be running that level, you know, like why are we prioritizing jumping a certain height or going so fast or pushing the horse literally to its limits? I'm sure people remember what happened with Elisa Wallace. And I mean, it's not necessarily a comment on her character, but what happened with her at, was it badminton or Burley where she got yellow carded for,
I think it was badminton. No, Burley. I don't know.
It's one of the B ones.
I think it was badminton.
Yeah. And she got carded for pushing her horse past exhaustion. And I'm like, if the event is that hard where a horse at that level can still be so wiped out, like, it just, I don't know, that's where I've run into
issues. It's honestly, like, I'm not an event rider, but, like, horse shows in a lot of ways, they're just becoming, like, a massive dick measuring contest. Exactly. Everyone is trying to flex their wealth, how nice their horse is, how much they can do, how big, scary of jumps they can do, how many scary cross-country fences they can do. They, like, and I think that's where we get greedy, because humans are naturally just greedy beings, and then we're all trying to just prove that we're the best at the expense of the horse.
Well, and then people start thinking that knowledge and intellect are mutually exclusive with competition level and success. And that is not the case because I would argue you and I are not the most, you know, show accomplished individuals in the horse world, but we are probably more knowledgeable on a lot of the subjects and a lot of the top, you know, young riders and professional riders. And it's just because that's not what you're taught. And when you go to, like, pony club, you get taught how to rap, maybe. A little bit about feed.
You don't get taught the behaviors. And that's the thing. Like, an upper-level rider for sure could ride a course better than me, for sure. Like, 100%. They'd be able to get on and they'd be able to do it because they've had way more practice at that level. But they would probably be missing out a lot of behaviors of their horse that I'm looking at and noticing. Yeah. And, like, certain aspects of, like, people's... Like, honestly, when I'm walking through new places, I can't help it. I'll just be kind of scoping out how fair it is to the horse, if the horse looks unsound, if they're in pain, and, like, I don't know.
Yeah. And if you say anything, you're like, they're like, well, the horse wouldn't be doing it if it didn't want to. And I'm like, yeah, it has nothing to do with your bits and whips and equipment. Like, you're right.
Yeah, then when it says no, you just beat it.
Yeah, okay.
Like, Well, and it's sad because the horses that put up with that are so resilient and, like, like good-natured. And then the ones that can't mentally handle it and crumble and turn into, like, basket cases, they're always ruled as the bad horses. But realistically, they're just not as able to cope with the mistreatment as other horses.
Right, nor should they be. And I completely agree. I mean, like, I think you and I have what would be defined as the typical problem horses, because Zoe came from, I mean, she was very hot and just could not tolerate the things that most horses can tolerate in the show environment. She was beyond stressed out. And I mean, like I told you, she was standing in the corner of her stall, bumping her nose against the wall. And most horses at shows, you know, I don't see them doing that. Some weave and some crib, and I mean, they have stereotypes, but Zoe was particularly sensitive to it. And I know Milo has some issues in his history and traumas. Oh, yeah. And
it's sad because people wouldn't notice it in the same way. And I've actually had people tell me things about his behaviors that just, like, simply aren't true.
Mm-hmm.
Like, when he used to pin his ears at people when he'd bring his food in, and he wouldn't do anything, but he'd just pin his ears and make a mean face. And people would be like, oh, he's being so bad. Like, he's so aggressive. Like, he needs to be put in his place. And this was when, like, he was in an in-and-out paddock, and the lady chased him out of the paddock, and he caught his hip on the door. Ugh. And he's still afraid of doorways because of it, on and off. But they labeled it as, like, him being aggressive, when really, like, he had gone for so long without any food that there's, like, a panic response almost. Like, you want to make sure you get it, and you're getting possessive of it. And now he doesn't pin that badly, and he doesn't act that aggressive. Mm-hmm. But what he does do around grain time is he makes, like, a chewing motion with his mouth, like, kind of like, I have to film it one time. He just kind of chews his mouth with his jaw sideways, and it's kind of like nervous tick.
Yeah, I can't remember. I think in Raquel Dreisman's book, The Language Signs and Calming Signals, she talks about that. Sometimes they call it a jaw stretch, and I think there's something else. There's also a difference between, like, tongue out licking and just licking and chewing. And stuff like that. And I mean, and my favorite.
I'd love to learn more about tongue out licking, because he does that all the time after I feed him stuff.
Yeah, it's normally kind of like a, if I'm not mistaken, I'm pretty sure, it's been a minute since I read the book, but I'm pretty sure it's a come down from the sympathetic nervous system. And I would assume at that, like, at the time he's getting really worked up and anxious, like excited or nervous from past history about food. And then he's kind of coming down after, like you said. But I think my favorite thing that's a perfect example of what you're talking about is people commenting on your things being like, oh, chestnut mares, am I right?
he's like a gelding.
Yeah.
And like, honestly, like, he just likes the things that he likes, you know? Like, he can't be bothered to meet a horse that he's not met before. He doesn't really care about most of them. And he's not a mare. He's, like, honestly the most expressive horse I've ever met in terms of what he's willing to communicate with other horses and with people. And that's not something that people should be, like, stereotyping in a bad way, you know? And I feel bad for mares, because they, like, with Zoe too, a lot of people would probably want to write off her behaviors as, like, her being in heat or like moody because she's a mare, and it's not.
Mares are more sensitive. It's hotter because females are, you know, genetically more emotional, which is not fucking true at all. It's all about socialization, people. But with mares, it's anthropomorphic. You just put the things that you believe about people, which are inaccurate, onto the animals. And then, I mean, that's where the whole dominance theory shit comes in. And then,
like, see, I said that. I said that if we're going to be feminists, we need to not stereotype
I
all
I thought that was the best thing. No, I know. But it's also because people have an issue with being feminist. But
I like feminism is important, because it is weird. And, like, just in general, how much we just enforce certain static views in society, like, even on animals, like, it's so weird.
Yeah, and I agree. And I mean, like, I think people get because I mean, I'm the same way, and I'm in South USA, so I mean, it's especially not accepted here to be anything left. So I have some, you know, views that I'm like, oh, maybe that's not how the rest of the world thinks and actually how I think. I've just been kind of indoctrinated that way. And feminism is one of them, because, you know, I'm used to people screaming and only focusing on the people that are being so loud and ridiculous. It's kind of like, I compare it to vegans. like people that hate the vegans that are like, horse riding is abuse, and also anything to do with touching animals and not just letting them be wild is abuse. Like, those people are not, they do not speak for the majority of vegans, and that's how I feel about feminism. And I'm
well, yeah, and then everyone sees them and yeah, they hate them because of it. And it's true, because some people take way too radical of a stance, and even if they have good ideas, it scares people away from it because it's just too...
That's exactly what happened with me in positive reinforcement. I went way too far. That's what I was actually thinking of,
is that people go too hard, and then they make people not want to try it at all.
Right, and that's what happened to me. I know it was a guilt reaction that I was like, fuck, I have to distance myself as far away from all of that as I can, and now I've kind of, like... leveled out a little bit, where I'm still predominantly positive reinforcement minded, but I definitely use negative reinforcement pretty often. But it's in, I try to make it in more of a non-escalating way, which is arguably quite difficult, but that's the goal. But yeah, so I mean, I agree with the feminism. When you said that about mares, I was like, oh my God, nail on the head. Because nobody's ever really called Zoe marish because she doesn't really pin her ears ever, and that I guess is what makes a mare is ear pinning.
Yeah, that's what makes Milo Milo, apparently.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just, it cracks me up that like people are like, oh my God, you can't say, you know, oh, you're acting that way because it's your time of the month, or because you're a woman, you're overly emotional. People get offended, but then they turn around and say the same exact shit about their animals. I'm like,
yeah. And then the bad thing is, I've seen it cover up like so many mares that are just genuinely like in pain and uncomfortable.
They get it written off
as just like being in heat or just being a bitch, and then they get like they have to just learn how to just put up with it, you know, and they just have to cope with it.
It's quite sad. And when I was it was more of a like scientific spin on the heat thing. I was at a clinic, and Zoe was like tossing her head and swishing her tail as her, you know, what she's known for is the propeller tail. And everybody always was like, oh my God, she's so spicy, spicy bean. Like, look at her tail. It's a propeller. Oh my God. And I used to say it was like a kid with ADHD that like just needed an outlet for like, cause I have like restless leg. And I was like, I was like, oh, it's the same thing. It's not, she doesn't do it when she's hanging out and she's not under any duress. It's only when I'm pissing her off and, asking too much of her. And I had a clinician when she was doing all of that say like, well, maybe she's cycling and she has cysts on her ovaries, which is a totally legitimate possibility. But there's also the potential explanation that she is not enjoying what I'm asking her to do, or she's confused, or she's afraid, or she's in pain. And it doesn't have to be because she's a mare. Like, you know.
Yeah. Probably. It's quite sad. I don't know. There's so many things to talk about, and just how behind the horse world is compared to other industries.
It's I've been sitting here thinking we're talking about feminism. Supposed to be talking about stalls. But I think we can probably wrap it up because I think we're approaching anchors.
No, that's great. And then, yeah, the next podcast will be about young horses, which we talked about a bit here because we got off track.
And can't help it.
We're going to go more in detail with that because that's a lot to unpack as well. Same thing.
So we'll also have to probably struggle to keep it. I really didn't think we could talk for 2 hours about this, but here we are.
Honestly, I was like, oh yeah, like an hour. Yeah.
Totally. Nope.
Honestly, I ramble enough on my own. So if I talk to someone else that's just down to do that, then it escalates.
Same. I have the people in my life try not to call me unless they have time, because I know it'll go on forever because I will talk. And that's why I have a podcast where I have multiple hour and a half long, like an hour and a half and an hour have become kind of my norm. And 40 minutes is easy. Like, I can shout into the void for 40 minutes and not have a problem. And I'm sure you might relate with the ADHD, where you start getting a little bit of brain fatigue and you're like, I've stopped listening to half of the things you're saying. Because I can't pay attention
anymore.
I'll literally forget
what I'm talking about while I'm saying it. I'll just have to pretend that I know what I'm talking about.
That happened to me on this episode, and I normally have to pause and go back. And I had to do that when I was filming the dominance theory thing, because I tangented so hard I forgot what point I was trying to make with my tangent. Anyway, I guess in closing, I think one of my closing questions that was going to be a nice wrap up, but I think we just have kind of covered everything. It's hard to talk about this stuff linearly, was, making things, better for stalls, you know, health environment, if you have lack of ownership, like how do you think you could make the stalls better? I mean, I don't think, Do you have anything else to say outside of, like, enrichment?
I think we covered it. Like, at its core, boarding barns just need to start building the barns better and changing how they traditionally build them.
Yeah, I completely agree. And stop thinking it's better for the horses, because science does not support it. And our industry, for some reason, is so bad about that. We are the most arrogant. I guess it's the Dunning-Kruger
effect. It's because the elitism. It's too many rich, privileged, generally white people all together.
And that, like, I mean, and I mean, I'm generally white and I'm rather well off and have lived that way my whole life. And, you know, having to seek out information is difficult. I won't lie. It requires a lot of commitment and effort, and it is hard, and it's much easier just to say, nope, I'm right, and stick your nose up in the air and say everybody else is wrong. And but I really think that, like, I mean, the best thing to do is just educate yourselves. And I was going to say something. I hate this. So, like, out of energy. This is why I also wanted to record the episode on another day, because I knew this would happen.
We couldn't do two in a row. Definitely not.
The second episode would be useless. But I don't know. I just think that we should really take steps to... Oh, I was going to say something about the Dunning-Kruger effect. See, I just did that thing where you just keep talking and you know what you're talking about. But the Dunning-Kruger effect, I think, is so prevalent in the horse world, which is that the less you know, the more you think you know. And there's this arrogance about, like, if you don't know anything, you think that you're so right about stalls are better and this equipment is better and using gadgets is better and surgeries or the quick fix solutions are all better because it's self-serving. And I think that's what happens with the stalls too. It makes us feel better. It makes
us feel better. The more you know, the more you start to question your surroundings. And it's not just applicable to the horse world. It's applicable to everything.
Which is the imposter effect, the counterpart to Dunning-Kruger.
Yeah,
I have to flex I have to use my undergrad psych degree for something. It's just things like that.
But if we start to change, like, the thing is, if our generation starts to make significant change in the horses that are growing up to be, like, future athletes, their dispositions are all going to start to become, like, there's not going to be the horses that can't handle being outside or that are just crazy. Exactly. If people just start to change how they do things.
Yeah, and beyond that, we're already seeing a significant increase in the horse's lifespan. And I think we would also see a big increase in use longevity, like how long you can ride them if we would change the way we care and manage them and train them. But we're not talking about training in this episode. We're trying very hard to pull
next episode training. Speaking of care and training them up the levels and long careers, that's going to be the next topic.
That'll be on this podcast.
Has been a good podcast and there's so many interesting things, so it's easy to go off track. But let's wrap it up before we go off track again.
And we're quickly approaching 2 hours. So I think just anything you'd like to plug, where people can find you, what your podcast is, et cetera, et cetera.
My podcast is called Making Milestones, and you can get it on Anchor and 8 other platforms that I don't remember what all of them are.
Much the same mine are on, probably, I would assume. Wherever you're listening to mine, you can probably find
Shelby. I also have YouTube, which is just my name, Shelby Dennis, and then my Instagram, which is SD Equus, EQ.
What about brand consistency, Shelby? None of that is the same. How dare you?
Yes. I know. I have no... I couldn't decide what to call my podcast, so I was just like...
You're talking to the indecisive queen.
I've changed it 3 times.
Oh my god. I'm going on my 3rd. It was Equine Theory, and now currently it's Jet Real. But when this goes up, it'll have a new name. And I just yesterday I filmed the episode announcing that I'm going to change the name, but then I chickened out at saying it at the beginning. So I just, like, kept explaining all of why I had changed it. And then at the end of it, I was like, I had, like, talked myself out of the name that I had picked.
And so I'm like, you picked a different one?
No, so I still haven't announced it. And I said in that episode, this is probably going to be meta for the people listening to this one, but I just decided, I was like, okay, I'll announce it in the next episode. So I have until Tuesday to kind of pick a new, or I guess next Tuesday to pick a new name. And then, so this intro to this episode will probably have the new name. And then,
oh, cool. I can't wait to hear.
Yeah. And then it'll end with me being like, I still don't know what the podcast name is, but
what's the name?
Yeah, it's hard to change
it again. Just the next episode, my new name.
Yep. But anyway,
yeah, thank you for having me on your podcast.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, there's a lot of good things to talk about. I think it would also be cool to do one with all of us, and then Marsh, who's all that's Alta Ventura.
Oh, I know. She was like, I'm so excited to hear about the guests, and I was like, well, you just signed yourself up, so.
she's great. That would be awesome.
Yeah. I would love to have her on. But yeah, I think this has been awesome. I'm sure I'll have you on again at some point in the future.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to doing our one for my channel too.
Yeah, me too. And I definitely want my listeners to listen to all of that. But I'll go ahead and hang up with you and then finish up here. And I guess you and I will talk on Sunday for your episode.
Yeah, sounds good. Thank you.
Awesome. Yeah, talk to you later.
Bye.
Bye. Alrighty, guys. I thoroughly enjoyed that. I did not expect it to go in all of the directions that it did. That was absolutely insane. But I think we hit on a lot of topics, and you know, I tend to agree with Shelby on most things. And it's interesting because we talked at the beginning. I think before we got on the call that we've publicly and privately argued on a bunch of training and welfare. You know. We've differed on a lot of stances on concepts. Fuck, I can't spit it out. But anyway, I think we've both kind of grown in education that we're, even though we disagreed so wholeheartedly at the beginning, we've both moved in the same direction because we've been studying separately and have come to the same conclusions because of the science that's out there. So even people that were starkly different at the beginning are coming together because of education. And I think that's its power. And that's why podcast episodes like this are so important to me, because it's, we can all form a more cohesive, you know, industry and society if in the equestrian community, if we, prioritize education rather than, like, as me and Shelby were talking about, just relying on boarding barns and instructors and taking it upon ourselves to further our education. And if you're listening to this podcast, I probably don't need to tell you that. I'm preaching to the choir. But if not, I do have a website, jedequitheory.com, where I have endless resources and blogs and all that good stuff on how to do positive reinforcement and all that good stuff. And I have some things I want to write about dominance theory and some blogs coming, and they might be up by the time I post this. Who knows? I'm recording this on August 14th, 2020. So who knows when it'll go up. But and also, I don't know what the name of the podcast is right now, so I can't say to, like, follow it on socials. But whatever I said at the beginning of this episode, follow that on Instagram, because that'll probably be the username. And Facebook. And then you can check me out at JedEquitheory on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and Twitter. That one will probably not change anytime soon. But yeah, I hope that you guys really enjoyed this episode. I had a great time talking to Shelby, and it's so funny because we just disagreed so heavily back in the day. And it was funny because we did a video together on YouTube. It was kind of like a separate collab, like she did part one and I did part two or something like that. And we were like, we were acquaintances, friends back then, and then it just really hit a rift and we argued a lot, and now we're back on the same page. And I think it's really cool that Shelby, you know, she's a person that's like not gonna hold grudges, and I'm pretty much the same way. And I think people like that are hard to come by, and people that are willing to admit that you know, they've been wrong. And we talked about it, you know, privately before the podcast, that we're just both like, yeah, we just didn't know back then, and now we do. And that's okay, and don't hold any resentment. People are allowed to grow and change, and I think that that is going to be one of the most powerful takeaways in the future. You know, we're talking about how we want to see these changes happen, and the most important thing, I think, is to not shame people into, you know, changing, or shame them for not changing, because then you're just going to drive them further into defensiveness, and they're going to want to stay there, because if they admit they're wrong, then there's a bunch of shame and negative emotions that come with it. So I think it's best to, you know, you can help people along and stand up for what you believe in. But at the same time, if people are willing to change, be open to that and accept that, and welcome them, and don't be like, oh, well, you were an idiot before, like, that it's not helpful, and it makes people want to leave your side again. So not that this is all manipulation, but I'm just saying, like, be a decent human and allow people to grow and change. You are not the same person you were 5 years ago. I hope not. And so there's no there's no sense in being rough on people for changing their opinions. I do it all the time. And then I talk about it and I have to be like, okay, well, actually, I don't believe that anymore. So yeah, I don't know. I really enjoyed this episode and I hope you guys did too. And I have a lot more exciting guests planned for this podcast. And this was my first interview. And oh my God, my heart was beating so fast at the beginning. Not because I'm like scared of Shelby or thought she was going to say anything mean. I was just so nervous. I've never had to do it before. It was a different pressure than I'm used to. But I'm so used to my quiet comfort of my house alone. But yeah, so thank you guys for listening. Be sure to check us out on the socials, check out my website, and subscribe to this podcast so you can listen, keep listening, stay up to date, don't miss an episode. I post every single Tuesday, and be sure to leave a review if you would like, so we can promote the podcast a little bit. I've been playing with a it's like a tripod phone connector, but it allows you to turn it sideways. And I have been playing with it for the duration of the podcast because I need something to do with my hands. And I kept dropping it, but whatever. I'm going to end it because this has been way too long already and your ears are probably tired. So thank you guys for listening, and I will catch you guys next Tuesday.